Archives are at whiteRoseSociety.org if you want to check that out. And last but not least, ladies and gentlemen, remember, it's your democracy too, and it's not a spectator sport. This has been Bruce Birch for the Bruce Birch Radio Program. We'll see you on Monday. Talk to you soon.
From Groton to Tacoma, on many a factory floor, the workers talk of solidarity and refuse to build weapons of war. No more will we make missiles. We're gonna do something different. And for the first time, their children were proud of their parents. Somewhere in Gaza, a little boy smiled and cried. After the revolution...
This is the Quality News Network. A criminal investigation has been launched into the March deaths of four Iraqi family members by U.S. soldiers. A U.S. official says at least one of the soldiers has admitted his role and has been arrested. The other four are confined to the base. Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki will begin a tour of the Gulf tomorrow with stops in Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, and Kuwait. The goal of the tour is to put a halt to sectarian violence. In an audio tape released yesterday, Osama bin Laden praises slain al-Qaeda leader Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, who was killed by U.S. forces earlier this month. Bin Laden also accused the U.S. of refusing to release al-Zarqawi's body out of fear that a large showing at his funeral would show the strength of the insurgency. In Gaza City, Israel has so far struck more than 30 targets, including the interior minister's office, and killed at least two militants while trying to free an abducted soldier. The Palestinian prime minister says Israel also wants to take down the Hamas-led government. Egypt has now come into the fray, serving as a mediator. In North Carolina, the governor says 300 state National Guard troops were deployed today to the Mexican border. In addition, Kentucky's governor announced 650 National Guard troops could be deployed by July. President Bush's plan called for 2,500 troops to be stationed at the border by today, but as of yesterday, there were less than 1,000. In New York City, the former police commissioner reached a plea agreement related to corruption charges. He is accused of accepting tens of thousands of dollars while he was in charge. Under a deal, he'll avoid jail time but be fined more than $220,000. In Memphis, Tennessee today, President Bush and the First Lady took Japan's Prime Minister to Elvis Presley's home, Graceland. The Japanese Prime Minister, who's leaving office in September, has been one of the President's strongest supporters in world affairs. In Florida, ahead of Saturday's launch of the Space Shuttle Discovery, NASA officials and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service are gathering up dozens of turkey vultures and other birds. They're capturing the birds to prevent them from flying into the shuttle and possibly damaging it. Across the Northeast, tens of thousands of residents are cleaning up after flooding forced them from their homes. Officials say damages could be as high as $100 million. In Kuwait, results from the parliamentary election show that no women won any seats. You're listening to the Quality News Network.
Most people would rather have a root canal than go to a dealer to buy a car. But you can turn dread into joy when you learn how to play the car buying game. Read the book, Right Car, Right Price, and you'll discover how the game is played and how you can win every time. Whether you're buying a car or a truck, new or used, Right Car, Right Price explains how to find and buy the vehicle best suited to your individual transportation needs. Auto Week called Right Car, Right Price the right stuff. So take the hassle out of car buying. Read Right Car, Right Price, and every time you get into your new car, you'll know you've got a great deal. Go online to rightcarrightprice.com to order your copy today. It only takes an hour to read Right Car, Right Price, and it just costs $10. We even pay the postage. So go to rightcarrightprice.com right now. It'll be one of the best decisions you ever make.
A Medicaid rule that goes into effect tomorrow requires that people show a passport or birth certificate before applying for benefits. The new rule aims to cut fraud by illegal immigrants. President Bush has nominated a Columbia University professor to serve in the Federal Reserve. On February 1st, Bush nominee Ben Bernanke took over as the head of the board. The Commerce Department reports that consumer spending slowed in May. The government report cites rising gasoline prices as a reason for the slowdown. JetBlue is a favorite low-cost carrier among travelers, according to a new survey. Continental Airlines was ranked the best full-service carrier. Drug maker Bayer is selling its diagnostics operations to Siemens in a more than $5 billion deal. The acquisition is part of Siemens' plan to expand its healthcare equipment and services business. The FDA has approved the first generic version of the antidepressant Zoloft. An Israeli pharmaceutical company plans to make the generic version of the Pfizer drug, which loses its patent tomorrow. Microsoft says it will cut about 5% of its sales force, or 214 jobs, to boost its competitiveness. French lawmakers have approved legislation that could weaken Apple's hold on the online music market. Under the law, Apple would have to make its iPod music player and iTunes online music store be compatible with rival services. At the close of Wall Street this week, the Dow was down 41 points, NASDAQ down 2, S&P 500 down 3. There's more at Quality News.
Bob Kincaid. Head On is brought to you every night by the West Virginia District Council of Carpenters and Millwrights. Union Carpenters and Millwrights. They're building the American dream. Free speech isn't free if you don't use it. So call Bob now at 1-877-4-HEAD-ON. That's 1-877-443-2366. Now, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy. Well, it's kind of Friday, isn't it? It is indeed, and I'm Bob Kincaid, and we are at the end of a broadcast week, at least as far as this show is concerned, for the next 3 hours or so. It's been a busy week. It's been a little bit hectic, been a little bit crazy. I've sort of tested the waters with what happens after this program. Our good friend John Fox at All Foxed Up. The Darling Agnes has produced some. I've produced some. We've collaborated on some. I think the biggest fun we've had with All Foxed Up is jointly picking bumper music that would mess with John's head. And I think we have succeeded. Great show, and oh my God, what an interview on the part of our compadre, Bruce Birch, with Counselor Swift. Amazing, isn't it? We get people on this show, this network, these programs. Kind of makes you a little bit proud, doesn't it? Well, it does me. It does us. So, you know, that's where we are as this last Friday in June 2006 rolls around. And I find myself asking a question this evening. I haven't touched on, because, you know, it's really, really hard to touch on the issue of Palestinians and Israelis without somebody calling you something somewhere along the way. But I can't remain silent any longer. That's not to say that I've been just a boiling pressure cooker to get into this, because it's usually painful, and you usually pay for any level of candor in which you engage in regard to this thing. But I've been pondering it for a couple of days, and I wondered, is there anywhere else on the face of this sweet little blue-green marble that is, in fact, the time machine that hurtles through time and space and the universe, and we call home, we call it Earth. Is there any other space on this planet where one government could kidnap? I mean, come on. For God's sakes, let's use the right language. Let's at least be a little bit honest about it. Is there anywhere else on this planet where one government could kidnap another one? And the rest of the world would go, well, of course. And if you get down to it, yeah, there's one other place. And, of course, I'm referring to the kidnapping of a big chunk of the parliament of the Palestinians by the Israeli government. Look, they're not guest workers, okay? They were kidnapped. Just like that one lone Israeli soldier was kidnapped. I kidnap you, you kidnap me, I kidnap your mother, you kidnap my father. Oh, what a lovely little spiral of hate and hell and damnation that does create, doesn't it? But it is kidnapping, right? Yeah, it kind of is. No, it's not kind of. It is. But it turns out there is one other place on planet Earth where you can get away with that. Oh, God, it's embarrassing. It's Texas. Because you do remember that a couple of years ago when a whole bunch of Democrats in Texas got a little chapped about having their government stolen from them by Tom DeLay and a bunch of fascist Republican SOBs, they walked out. Do you remember what Tom DeLay did? Tom DeLay picked up the phone and tried to have the Texas Rangers kidnap the Democratic members of the Texas legislature. Now, I don't know who got the idea from whom, but it's pretty clear that there's some communication going on. But it leads me to a larger question. And that larger question is, I'm going to get in trouble. The hate mail's going to come in. But I have to ask at what point in time the Palestinian people are going to stop behaving like a slave society. Because, you see, there have been slave uprisings all over the world, all through history. Spartacus, anyone? Spartacus wound up with a crucifix up his rear end, busy being a streetlight on the Appian Way. Yeah, ow. And, you know, substitute the century, the outcome is the same. So what I'm getting at here is that if you're bedraggled, if you're beaten down, if you are abused, and you respond to that abuse by doing what seems like the only thing you have left to do, and that is doing something really mean and awful and blowing up somebody's kid on the other side. That's slave society behavior. That's a slave uprising. Because hurting some civilian can only be regarded by the rest of the world as a blind and somewhat uncivilized lashing out. Now, you and I may sit down and say, well, you know, geez, you know, when all you got's rocks, rocks is what you throw. But it isn't. It isn't that way. Now, there were slave uprisings in India against the Raj during Britain's brutal colonial rule of the subcontinent. But only when Mohandas K. Gandhi came along and said, "Nah, see, that's the thing. The British are really good at responding to people who are every bit as mean as the British. They're very good at that. They'll herd you into a stadium and close the doors and open up the machine guns and a whole bunch of people die. I mean, yeah, and it doesn't matter if your name's O'Malley or Patel. They're very, very good at that. It's only when you put them in a position where they can no longer respond in that fashion without the entire, without being upbraided by the entire world, that you begin to have an effect. And that, I submit to you, is the front end of the concept of nonviolence. So I have to ask, when will the Palestinian people learn to stop behaving like a slave society? I heard an interview coming home on National People's Radio with a UN official who said, "Well, you know, I've got a bit of petrol stored away, you know, a few thousand liters, and it might be good for, you know, 4 or 5 days, but I can't let it out." And he said, "My heart goes out to the people in the hospitals. The generators, are, you know, the power grid has been destroyed. And soon the generators will start running out of petrol. And then the people who are living on respirators in the Palestinian hospitals will die." And, you know, that's just what it is. It's just facts. And I think somehow... we've got to find out from, well, okay, if you're going to ask those questions of the Israeli people, you need to ask them the American people as well. Are you willing, in the name of your government, to have old people on respirators suffocated to death because a soldier got kidnapped? And the same question has to be asked of the American people. Because two buildings, two really, really tall buildings and a chunk of the Pentagon got destroyed by people who weren't Iraqi, are you? At what point do you stop being willing to watch old people in hospitals in Iraq die of suffocation? The Israeli people need to answer that question. The American people need to answer that question. Because I think if you asked it of the average American or the average Israeli, the answer would be, never, 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 sweet Jesus, dear Moses, never. Because you see, 70% of the power grid is dead in the Gaza Strip right now. The water pumps out of the wells are failing. The generators, the emergency generators for the hospitals are running out. And Ehud Olmert, you know, he's prime minister now because, that old fat dude ate one piece of pastrami too many? Had a stroke, shuffled off. Home to Abraham or whatever. Look, it ain't anti-Semitic, it ain't anti-Arab, it ain't anti-nobody. But when are the Palestinians going to find themselves a Gandhi and start being a member of the world community? That's just my question. Am I missing the point? If I am, feel free to let me know. The phone number is 877-443-2366, but this is a legitimate question. This is the Head On Radio Network, and I'm Bob Kincaid.
There's a place on the web you can go where everything is so topical, you can apply it liberally. WD40.com. Clyde, Wally, and Dookie are there working hard for you every day. It's a place where you can go to raise your voice and be heard. WD40.com. WBYAD40.com. So stop on by. The 101st Fighting Keyboardists of Kansas are ready to hear your opinion. There are topics of news, current events, and great humor. So let Clyde, Wally, and Dookie know that you're a working person too. WD40.com. Stop on by.
Being Latino made it harder because there's a silence over things. There's just things that you don't talk about.
Real men, real depression. Rodolfo Pomelu Leon talks about it.
When I told my parents I had depression, I was like, look, Mom, I'm depressed. You know, I can't deal with things anymore. And once I involved other people, it became easier.
It takes courage to ask for help. For information, call the National Institute of Mental Health at 1-866-227-NIMH.
Dad, let's sing that bedtime song.
Rock-a-bye baby by Newton's treetop. His first law of motion, make sure you won't stop. The same rules of physics apply to a ball. While gravity is a force that makes things fall.
By the sixth grade, many girls lose interest in math and science, but it's never too early to set your daughter's future in motion. For some simple ideas, go to girlsgotech.org.
A public service announcement brought to you by Girl Scouts of USA and Ad Council.
What would happen if you didn't follow the established path? If you did the unexpected? Would you feel scared? Proud? Relieved? Could you explain that helping the people of Peru improve their own community would also have an effect on your own? Or assisting an entrepreneur in Ukraine to launch her small business? Or creating a support group in Malawi for children orphaned by AIDS? What if you established your own path? One that others might follow? Would you rather make your own way? Or spend your life saying, what if? Life is calling. How far will you go? Peace Corps. To find out more, call 1-800-424-8580. Or go to peacecorps.gov.
And a half minutes after the hour, I'm Bob Kincaid. And it is, in fact, here in the mountains of Appalachia, it is a beautiful, it is an exquisite summertime, early summer, Friday evening. In some other parts of the world, it's already Saturday, however. One of those parts would be the United Kingdom, more particularly Wales, and our friend Andy joins us there from. Andy, good evening.
Good evening, Bob. How are you?
I'm very well. Yourself, sir?
Yeah, not too bad, man. Not too bad. The weather's actually pretty good over here, too. It's been nice and sunny today. So the plants are growing. The tomatoes are doing well.
I should think this would be when it starts really getting nice.
Yeah, well, it was supposed to do that about the start of June, but obviously it's Britain, so it's a bit temperamental at best. So we had about a week of pretty horrible cloud, like, sort of over the last week. But the last couple of days have been good, so... Yeah, typical British weather. we normally have like 4 weeks of intense sun, which is probably what's coming up now. And, you know, we'll have old people dying in their homes and stuff this year again. Because we're not adjusted for it and we don't care about our old people.
Well, yeah.
Drives me nuts.
Well, you know, it's odd. In most so-called civilized countries where they worry about folks dying, freezing to death in the winter, it turns out there's some studies out there. It's less likely to happen in the winter because we're just like there are actually fewer car accidents on during the rain than there are during dry weather?
Yeah, absolutely. It's the principle of...
You pay attention to it.
Well, yeah, you look at the situation and go, need to be careful. I mean, have you heard of the new study that made roads safer in Holland?
No.
They had this genius idea. They took out all the signs and all the street markings, everything. The only thing they left on the road were the parking bays at the side of the road.
And thereby cut down distractions to the drivers?
Speeding stopped. There was one sign coming into the town, you know, 30 kilometres an hour, and speeding just stopped. There was nobody doing more than 1 or 2 kilometres over that. And then the number of accidents went down like 20%. Number of fatal accidents went down by 90%.
Very interesting, because there was a study released, I caught it in the paper today, that cell phone users, whether they're whether they're holding the stupid little thing up against their head or using a hands-free unit in the car, they are as dangerous or more so than a drunk driver.
Oh, we've known that for years. We've had bans on people using mobile phones here. I mean, it's pretty much if a copper sees you using a mobile phone, he can put you up for 3 points on your license, and it's 12 points and you're out. Or he can give you a fixed penalty of like £80 or £150, depending on sort of how bad he thought you were doing. So they're just dangerous. I mean, you know, mobile phones came out and they were small enough for people to hold while driving, and accidents just started going up over here.
I think it must be the interactive quality, because there's not a concomitant study about people listening to their favorite music on the radio in the car.
No, I mean, the studies that we've had over here have shown that people who talk to another passenger or somebody in the back of the car even are much less likely to have any kind of accident. That's basically average accident risk. But if you're using a mobile phone, even with the hands-free kit, you're still very, very dangerous. I think it's because there's more than just a conversation going on. Because if you're talking to somebody in a car, there's the road noise all around you and the conversation with you. But if you're talking on a phone, you've got all the noise from their end. They might be sat inside a quiet room, but they might be next to somebody with a drill. They might be driving in a car somewhere else, you know. And it's the brain has to process all these different noises. So the more noises you pile into the ear, the more processing power is taken up with working out what the hell's going on at the other end of the phone. There's nothing you can do about it. It's what humans do. Do you know what I mean?
Well, sure. And the other part of that is that if you're engaged in a two-way conversation, you're thinking about what you're going to say next.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. But no, we're going to move on to the important topic.
Do please.
People dying in car crashes, while important, it could all be solved, and we know how. And that's not let the motoring companies have their way. How hard would it be to have blockers so cell phones don't work in cars? That could be made law. But anyway, Palestine and Israel.
Yes. Well, you realize we're going to get in trouble.
Yeah, okay. I'm going to say right from the start that I do not approve of the actions of the authority. Okay? Now, that doesn't matter which authority you want to pick. I don't approve of their actions. So you want to pick Israel, Palestine, Britain, France, America, China. I don't like them. All authority has proven itself over the last, 10 or 12,000 years to be corrupt and fascist and dictatorial.
Doesn't work so well.
Oh, it works so well, but, you know, I mean, the basic premise you had, while a good one, is flawed, and that's because the Palestinians aren't slaves, and Israel's been very careful not to make them slaves. Israel's purpose has always been to make sure the Palestinians feel that they have an authority which is working for them, but ultimately depressed enough that it's not going to do anything, so they don't bother doing anything.
But that makes it a slave culture, does it not?
Well, yeah, that's what I mean. Well, in the sense, you're right. It's a slave culture, but it's not a slave culture in form of actual slavery. No Palestinian can turn around and say, that Jew there forces me to do this work.
Right.
You can't do that, and that's the key separation. Putting that Palestinian authority in there has been the key work of Israel and the world that backed it. Into keeping the Palestinians divided. Now, the Israeli state looks at the Hamas explosions and Al-Aqsa explosions inside of Israel, suicide or otherwise, as perfect. It's absolutely perfect. The Israeli authorities do not want to stop Jews being blown up. Otherwise, they would have done. And it would be very easy, because if the Israeli authority was deadly serious about not having Jews blown up, they would have driven all the Palestinians into Egypt and into Jordan, and that would be it. And they'd build an enormous high-tech security border, and they wouldn't have people getting blown up. And that would have happened. But they're not serious about it, because
they need them.
Their existence depends on it. Why is the American 7th Armored stationed in the Israeli desert? you know what I mean?
Oh, yeah, I do. I do. This is
why are there, like, what was it, four or six squadrons of American F-16s in addition to all the F-16s you've sold Israel, in Israel at all times? Why are there American cruisers off the Israeli coast at all times? Because it serves America's purpose. Now, why does it serve America's purpose? Because it's not the Palestinians' fault. And ultimately, it's not even the Zionist, the most religious and crazy Israelis' fault. It's none of their fault. It's the fault of organizations like Britain and the United States. And recently, it's been carried by your government, the United States. Now, I mean, the United States basically exists to produce weapons and blow stuff up. That's what your entire economy has been switched to since, you know, the beware of the...
Well, since the Cold War.
...complex. Your whole society is based upon producing stuff that goes bang and making it go bang on people. Which is horrible.
And what doesn't go bang on people goes bang in people, you know, between McDonald's and between McDonald's and McDonnell Douglas.
Well, yeah, but that's it. You know, the whole system that you have is a system of absolutely zero care. And this is where, you know, the whole making people not talk about class has been key for them, because it always comes down to class struggle. I'm going to keep coming back to this for as long as I keep phoning you.
I know, and sooner or later, you know, I'm going to have to break down and get that Monty Python clip, Andy, with,
oh, there you go, bringing class into it again.
Well, that's it. Exactly.
But that's what it's all about.
It is. It's all about class. And it, you know, it doesn't matter how many Palestinian children get turned into red mist by Israeli stickered American planes. It doesn't matter how many Iraqis get turned into red mist by American stickered American planes. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter how many GIs come home with bits of them missing, or with depleted uranium soaking their bodies and their mutant children. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter how many come home and commit suicide by cop. It simply doesn't matter. And do you know why? Because all of that increases the GDP. And increasing the GDP, while logical and rational, is insane. Because GDP is basically, you know, you're diagnosed with cancer, perfect, it increases the GDP. Your cancer has been cured, GDP's gone down.
Yeah. Hey, Andy, do me a favor, stand by for a second. Agnes says we must run a break.
Okay, cool.
And we will come back and continue this discussion.
Okay, wicked. Cheers.
All right, great. Our Friday conversation with our UK correspondent, Andy, in Wales, will continue after this. This is the Head On Radio Network. I'm Bob Kincaid. Where the rain gets in and stops my mind from wandering where it will go. I'm feeling the cracks that ran through the door and kept my mind from wandering where it will.
Christina, I brought breakfast. Whoa, you're going out?
Already had breakfast. We've got a doctor's appointment.
The baby's sick? Why didn't you call me?
No, it's just a well baby check. We're going in for a second newborn screening today.
His what? What's a newborn screening?
Well, between 7 and 14 days, every baby needs this test done to screen for some rare diseases.
Oh, you're not sick. Hey, that baby's not sick. You can tell just by looking at him.
But you can't tell by looking. That's the point. Even healthy-looking babies can have a serious illness. Without this test, I might not know until it's too late.
Christina, you know, I think you're going to be a great mama.
Well, I have a little help this newborn screening, so I'm off to a good start.
For more information on this newborn screening program, call the Department of Health.
The major record labels say that downloading music from the internet is stealing. But according to these people, making a mixtape for your friend is stealing too. So is making a tape of a radio show.
Clone radio. We play the songs that sound more like everyone else than anyone else.
When a rock band plays an AC/DC cover at a bar that doesn't pay ASCAP. That's stealing. Or have you ever sung Happy Birthday to your friend at a restaurant?
Warning!
Happy Birthday is copyrighted, so if you're singing in a public place, you'd better be paying royalties, or you'll be stealing music.
Man down!
Does all this stuff about stealing music sound absurd? Would you rather have a world where our music culture wasn't the intellectual property of five corporations? Then stop giving them your money and make sure your friends and family don't either. Better yet, try burning them a CD. If we pull the plug on major labels, music gets better. Find out more about what you can do. Check out downhillbattle.org.
Traffic. All this traffic. When will it end? Doesn't it seem like there are more cars on the road every day?
As our population continues to grow, our daily commute isn't the only thing changing. Rapid population growth around the world threatens our quality of life in other ways. It endangers the environment, economic development, even the future health of our children. U.S. support for voluntary family planning programs worldwide improves everyone's quality of life and helps slow population growth. Find out how you can help increase support for these crucial programs. We're Population Action International, working to promote voluntary family planning around the world. Visit us at www.populationaction.org. That's populationaction.org.
Rain into a paper cup. They slither wildly as they slip away across the universe. Pools of sorrow, waves of joy are drifting.
24 minutes before the hour, I'm Bob. This is the Head On Radio Network. This is Head On for a Friday night. And, you know, I've been in a place lately where I've been contemplating the nature of existence, and I've decided that, you know, if the billions ever do roll in, I'm going to take at least 1 billion and set up a, you know, sort of like the way a knight would endow a cathedral to pray for his soul after he was gone. I'm going to endow an earth station to beam out a perpetual message: stay away, stay away. This is a place of hate and pain and misery and death. Stay away, stay away. Because that is sort of the welcome to Earth sign, isn't it? Ah, well. Back to the phones. Andy's been waiting. Hey, Andy, welcome back.
Hey, man, how's it going?
No, I'm okay.
I can see your point with that. I can see your point. And, you know, hey, look, if an alien turned up today and said, what's this place like, I'm thinking of selling down, I'd say, think again, do you know what I mean? Unless,
well, I think there's already a universal quarantine on this place.
I wouldn't be surprised. But, I mean, you know, this whole situation that we have with world capitalism, it makes it easy to understand why people think snakehead aliens are running the oil business. Because it is insane. It's totally and totally unhuman behavior. And I say unhuman, not inhuman, because inhuman means you're just being downright evil to another human.
Right.
But they are literally not human, the people that are making these decisions. And I don't mean that in that they go home and they don't kiss their wife and hug their kids and all that. They're human enough outside of the office. But the corporation they work for, which is, you know, the corporations are the new aristocratic nobility, the oligarchs, whatever you want to call them, do you know what I mean? They're the same ruling class. They're the elite, as they like to call themselves, or the scum, because what floats to the top?
Scum.
There you go. Now, you know, everything that goes on in this world is comes down to what they want. Now, do you remember last year they had those concerts, what was it, G8 concerts, that, like Live Aid, but modern.
Right, yeah, I do.
Well, the other night, Bob Geldof did a report a year on Newsnight about sort of what's happened, and his report was basically a load of empty air, as usual, and not a lot else. I mean, for example, the G8 say, oh, we gave $11 billion in a special aid package for dealing with childhood diseases. Well, they did. They gave £11 billion. Now, that's a lot of dollars, but the amount that actually got there was something like 2.75 after all the corruption, all the waste. So it didn't get anywhere because that's the amount that just got to Africa. What happened to it after that? Nobody knows. So that's all gone, $11 billion into the pockets of the rich. Now, the ruling class like Robert Mugabe and all the other crazy elites in Africa, they're probably universally hated by the elites of the West, but they're universally useful. Their task is to keep the people of Africa poor. And if you keep the people of Africa poor and depressed and hungry and starving and dying of disease, then they can't unite and protest against the exploitation, or no, the rape of Africa's resources. Enough stuff comes out of Africa every day to cure the entire world's ills, just instantly, once per day. That's how much wealth is ripped out of Africa in diamonds and cobalt and nickel and copper. Well, you name it, it comes out of Africa.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, why have we had a world situation where in the 1960s there were images of little black children with distended stomachs and skeletal bodies dying of famine in Ethiopia and other places? And then in the 70s and the 80s and the 90s and now and next decade and the decade after? Because they don't care. Because it's necessary and they don't care. Now, move on to other countries like ours, where we have a relatively good standard of living. We actually don't, do we?
Well, you know, I heard Dick Gregory speak once upon a time when I was a college student up in Morgantown, West Virginia, and he said, and the reason I thought of this was what you just said about the little African children with their distended bellies and their bony arms.
Mm.
And he said, you know, he referenced that too, Andy, and he said, that's a sign of famine.
Yeah.
He said, pick any corporate executive that you want.
Mm-hmm.
He's got the same distended abdomen and the same bony, non-muscular arms.
Mm-hmm.
And he, too, while he has enough money to do anything about it he wants to, he, too, when you get right down to it, is a victim of famine.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's harder to like the fat CEO.
Well, there's not much reason to like the fat CEO because they have the ability to change.
It's self-imposed.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's like the amount of pity I have for my better half when she's got a hangover in the morning. It's there, but it's not really relevant because she did it to herself. You know, I care, but not enough to go and buy her headache tablets. You can get them herself.
Well, I am told, Andy, that and you know, I come from coal mining people,
mm-hmm.
and you live in a place that was filled with coal mining people.
Oh, yeah, a lot of the hills around here are the slag heaps of coal mines.
Right. I'm told that my grandfather
mm-hmm.
would find himself a mile into the mountain on a Monday morning, sweating out a hangover.
Yeah.
And that every now and then, he would just, you know, be loading the car and talking to himself, and you'd hear him say, "You did this to yourself."
Yep.
"Don't complain about it. You had fun doing it."
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's
and hard. You know, he had no pity for himself. There is no pity for the self-inflicted. And I say that as a cigarette smoker.
Oh no, absolutely. You know, I've done things to my body that are not exactly the way you treat a temple. And you know, I accept the consequences. But I mean, you know, I look at things in the kind of, if I'm going to get cancer, I'm not going to get it because of anything I smoke. I'm going to get it because of the tons of depleted uranium that are soaking our atmosphere and making us all mutants. You know, I mean, ultimately everything comes down to a risk, but we have an odd society. And I mean, this has been engineered by the ruling class because we have a society where everybody wants all their rights, but nobody wants any responsibility.
But truth be told, Andy, I mean, I agree with what you're saying. But I'm filtering a lot of what I'm thinking these days through the lens of looking at my dad, okay?
Mm-hmm.
I'm not playing that for sympathy. It just is what it is, and I am who I am.
Well, yeah.
And back when I was in Alabama, I had his primary treating physician look at him when my father was asking a simple question about, you know, how am I, what's going on?
Mm-hmm.
And his primary treating physician looked at him and said, "Well, sir, you haven't been very kind to your body now, have you?"
Yeah.
And I really just wanted to punch him.
Well,
because you know, what he was focusing on was the fact that my father is diabetic and has some degree of emphysema because, at least in part, he smoked.
Well, yeah, you get the supercilious position, as it were. I mean, you know, that guy.
Well, that's when I jumped in, Andy, and I said, because my dad looked at me and said, "What's it?" Because my father was insulted. as well he should have been.
I would be too, but I mean the guy...
But I jumped in, Andy, and I said, what he means, Dad, is that you smoked and you ate what you wanted to. Now, what he didn't take into account, I said this right in front of the physician, I said, what he didn't take into account is the fact that you have breathed asbestos, and you have breathed coal dust, and you have breathed every, because my father worked around furnaces and coal mines.
Yeah, well, after all.
And I said, you've breathed every manner of industrial filth that there is for you to consume, and you did it so some fat dude could eat caviar more than once a week.
Yeah, don't call them dudes. Fat guy in a suit. Dudes are too cool for these people. No, absolutely right. I mean, the doctor looks at every patient, that doctor and others, many others like him, and they look at every patient as simply machines that have gone wrong, and a prophet is in there for fixing them. So there's no reason to have, like, proper sort of, you know, care. And I mean, we used to have the idea of TLC, tender loving care, from all doctors down to the lowest of the nurses. Now you don't get it from anyone, and they kick your family out if they're showing that too much emotion. You know, our whole system has become mechanized. We have this bizarre idea that industrialization and capitalism fixes all, and when in fact rampant capitalism will destroy everything, and industrialization generally, while a good thing, has been so badly managed, it's pretty much managed to destroy everything. You know, I mean, look at our society. Is capitalism the end point of human societal evolution? Is it? Well, I say no. And the reason I say no is because I look around and I see the mess this planet's in. And I see how many people die every day in my own country of totally unnecessary things. I mean, you know that Britain is about to suffer an epidemic. And this is an epidemic of liver failure in the 20s and 30-year-olds.
Where's that coming from?
It's coming from the slow and constant relaxation of the licensing laws and the constant reduction in price of drinks in Britain over the last 15, 20 years.
Well, you've been down that road before when the Dutch introduced gin.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That's why we had licensing laws in the first place, because people were literally drinking pints of gin and killing themselves. You know what I mean? That's why we have weights and measures in our pubs and clubs. That's why you can't sell triples, you know? But now they've recently changed the law so that pubs and clubs can open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. Now, local councils are resisting that, but, you know, here and there you're getting them creeping through, and when you get one, more and more come into the area. So instead of having, like, a big violent punch-up on the way home from the pub between about 11 and 1 in the morning when the pubs and clubs used to kick out, now there's huge, great violent punch-ups from 11 till 6 in the morning. In some areas, the police are obviously now on longer shift, and we're understaffed in our police force. The ambulance service is now on longer shift. We're understaffed there. Nursing, understaffed there. You know, the whole thing has been done just because the drinks industry wanted it done. And the net result is that we're having 28 and 29-year-old girls drop, you know, they're dropping dead of liver failure. And we're getting sort of 35-year-old blokes dropping dead of liver failure. Because they go out and they drink... I mean, I don't know, have you heard of an Alco Pop?
No.
Right, basically it's vodka or some other really strong alcoholic liquor, that spirit stuff, and then fruit juice, pre-mixed in a bottle.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah, they're blatantly aimed at kids. You know what I mean? Like they're blatantly aimed.
Oh, of course it is. I mean, when I was a teenager, Andy, we had to do it ourselves.
Yeah, yeah, but that's too hard for people these days. But I mean, these things, you know, that you can't taste the alcohol in them. I mean, I've worked in plenty of bars, and I mean, I don't drink, but you know, I've spoken to enough people and I've seen enough people getting drunk on them, and people don't realize how drunk they're getting, and of course they don't understand the body chemistry. So, yet again, the need for capitalist profit is destroying us. Because it costs us money from our taxes to pay for the police, pay for the ambulance, pay for the hospital care they need while they die, pay for the drugs. But the drinks industry doesn't cover any of that in the amount of tax it pays to the government, and they won't.
Well, no, if there's enough money in it, what you'll find, Andy, is that it will be surreptitiously taxed.
Mm.
And I don't mean to run off into another realm, but. There is, and I mean no insult, there is not a listener paying attention to this program right now who can actually figure out what the true cost of a kilowatt hour of the electricity they're using right now is.
No. Well, I mean that
because we invisibly subsidize coal.
Yeah, and the similar things happen here with oil and gas, and we don't have, I think we only have maybe one coal-fired station, and that's like an experimental one for sort of filters and stuff, I think. But, I mean, we have this, you know, electricity is expensive for the consumer, but very cheap for the seller in our country. I mean, I'm not sure what the difference is over there, but, I mean, they're making like sort of 60% profit and stuff on sale of electricity over here in some areas. And, of course, the people who are producing green energy get zero subsidies at all. You know, you want to set up a wind farm, no subsidies. We're not going to help you get the thing through the council planning office. Anybody object to the...
Oh, they tried to pass a 6-month moratorium on it here in West Virginia during a special session of the legislature, Andy.
But
at the same time, if you do any background stuff on Guantanamo at all, you know that Guantanamo is running on wind energy.
Well, absolutely. I mean, they use it where it suits them. I mean, you know, the U.S. has had solar panel technology for a very long time, and the military have been using that wherever they can because it's cheap and easy. It may not generate huge amounts, but if you need to run some computers and somewhere hot, a solar panel will do it. But obviously, where it comes to selling huge amounts of oil and gas to people and coal to people to make electricity for the consumer, then, well, there's money in that. And that's what it comes down to. I mean, look at... I'll give you an example, and then I'm going to leave you because you want to have other calls. But over here, we've got the Severn River that runs between Wales and England, and it's enormous. The Severn Estuary is, like, one of the biggest tidal estuaries in the world.
Big enough to inspire us to name a river here after it.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's one of two totally... two unique tidal estuaries that are World Heritage Sites. One's in the Amazon somewhere, and this one's here. They want to build a barrage across it. Now, I don't know if everybody knows what a barrage is, but basically it's a wall at which they dam up water behind it and then let it through twice a day when they've got enough water, and they get X amount of energy for 20 minutes twice a day. Now, they say they'll output...
Hydroelectric.
Hydroelectric, yeah, but it literally dams the entire river across the estuary. So it destroys the ecosystem utterly. All the birds that, I mean, literally thousands of birds every year, hundreds of thousands possibly, depend on these mudflats, and they'll be gone. And it produces energy for like 20 minutes twice a day to the same output as a nuclear power station. Now, forgive me if I'm wrong, but we don't have anything that have any batteries big enough to store that amount of energy, do we? I mean, I've never heard of... I mean, the national grid is live. That's the whole point of grid electricity.
Well, right, and I guess the thinking behind it is that there's enough capacity on the grid to pass it through without having to store it.
Well, yeah, but I mean, the electricity will only be passed around the grid while there's current behind it. So you're going to have other power stations constantly on, and every so often you'll get like a huge surge of power. Well, there's another plan that somebody came up with that's basically putting a load of wind turbines that are designed to work underwater in the channel of the Severn, just in a row.
Hundreds
of them running out to sea, following the current as it runs in and out each way. And that runs 24 hours a day, 365 days a year, and it produces... Each tower produces 1 megawatt. Now, you'd need, like, I don't know, a couple of hundred, and you provide enough power for the whole of Wales. You know?
I do, because you can take that same technology you just described. There are green energy catalogs in the United States, and I've looked at them, and I've thought about them a lot. Even small creeks running in front of houses, there are turbines that you can put inside the creek bed. Yeah. Or not in the creek bed, but in the creek.
Yeah, you plug a cable in, chuck it into the creek, and water runs past a bunch of turbine blades, and you get electricity the whole
time. Right. And so the damming doesn't become necessary.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you could...
But the thing is, the people that have money are in a position where what they have is the technology right now. They've spent a lot of money on the technology for building dams and not...
Well, look at it. Dams you need to sell oil because you need to power the vehicles that are going to provide all the movement and production of the concrete. You need vehicles to move all the rock. You need vehicles to pulverize the rock. You need mixing vehicles. All of this uses oil. You need water, tons of water. I mean, concrete's like one of the most ecologically unviable things to make in the short term.
True enough, Andy, but bear in mind that where I grew up and where I come from in North Alabama is such that I wouldn't have been born there had it not been for the Tennessee Valley Authority that dammed the Tennessee River. Which flooded like wild.
every year, killed people, ruined, you know, ruined crops, ruined farmlands, and the people along the Tennessee River ate dirt until the Tennessee Valley Authority came along.
Well, yeah, I mean, I'll agree that damming rivers has its place and stuff, but I mean, to be honest with you, you know, if you settle on a floodplain, prepare to be flooded is my advice to people. I've always been a fan of people like settling on maybe hillsides and stuff where you're not likely to just get washed away. But you know, I mean, the whole problem we have now is that might, and that means industrial might or military might,
makes right.
And that's it. That's the problem, because it's not right. It's wrong almost 100% of the time. Look at Israel. Might has served them very well. They've made a lot of money, but it's got a lot of people killed and made people very angry. And to paraphrase Michael Parenti, these people stand on our shoulders. And if we give a collected shrug, we can just shrug them off. So I'm going to leave you with that thought.
Well, that's very well said, Andy. And you brought it full circle, and I appreciate that. I am disturbed in the Muslim world, and I don't want to sound like some right winger because God knows I'm not. But the one question that is often raised is the fact that Iran and Egypt and Syria are constantly complaining about the plight of the Palestinians, and yet when it comes right down to it, they do very little for them.
Well, yeah, but because they're the ruling elites of their countries.
Well, now, exactly.
And it serves their purpose to bitch and moan and whine about how the Palestinians are oppressed by the Israelis and the Americans and the UN and all of this. But when it comes to putting the money where the mouth is, as it were, of course they're not going to do anything. They don't want to upset their state.
Well, I'll submit to you that there's even a little bit more covert racism than that, Andy.
Mm-hmm.
Because at the time of the Crusades, the Levant was populated in a large amount by what were called monophysite Christians.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, people that didn't get along with the Greek Orthodox nor the Roman Church. The Coptics were monophysites.
Yeah,
did not believe that Jesus was necessarily God-made man. You know, that kind of thing.
Thought it was a prophet, yeah.
But the Crusades come along, and there were populations that came from Europe and settled there and stayed there.
Mm.
And frankly, those people fornicated like bunnies.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know.
And the reason I say there's a racist component to this is that the Palestinians, probably more than any other demographic component in the Middle East, the Palestinians have an element or a component of Western European genetics.
Well, yeah, they do, absolutely. And I'd say there is a racism problem because, I mean, this is going to get me in trouble, but Arabs are notoriously racist. Notoriously racist. Now, I say that not meaning every Arab is a racist or every Persian is a racist, but the Arab governments of the South and the Persian governments in what is now Iran have always used race. Ever since the Romans caused them problems and the Parthians were deposed, race has always been used to divide their peoples. And so, yeah, they'll be bang alongside the Palestinians as long as it suits them, but right up until the point as it doesn't suit them, and then the Palestinians are back on their own.
Well, the Iranians talk about the Palestinian plight, and frankly it rings hollow to me, Andy, because the Iranians hate the Arabs, because they're not.
Well, they loathe each other. I mean, you know, the hatred they bear for the West is nothing compared to the hatred they bear for each other. I mean, the problems with Sunni and Shia come from the basic hatred of Arabs and Persians. It's you know, I mean, I imagine that the difference in scripture that they decided on when the Shia split from the Sunni was they're Arabs. Let's come up with a reason. And the Arabs went, they're Persians, let's come up with a reason. Right, we believe this in the Quran. No, we believe that. Good, we can disagree, let's fight.
Follow the shoe, follow the tree. Yes, absolutely. Straight out of Life of Brian.
Yeah.
Andy, we thank you so much. We do have to roll.
Wicked, man. Well, take care. Have a good
You have a great weekend, all right? I do so enjoy these conversations.
No, it's good fun, man.
Hey, oh, by the way, I'll be strung up by my heels if I don't say that you are being called upon in the chat room.
Well, my problem is I can't get in there. I keep getting dropped the whole time. I do try every now and
then. Well, do me a favor. If you go to headonradionetwork.com, don't try the sign-in box thing there. Just click the alternate link.
Yeah, I've always been doing that. I think it's the server at my end. I don't think it's very good quality, to be honest with you.
Well,
I won't mention the corporate name, but they're well known.
Okay, well, I've tried, okay?
Well, yeah, I will keep trying. I mean, I do get in every once and again. I haven't for a while, but I'll keep trying.
And we'll work on our end. Thank you so much, Andy.
Okay, wicked, man. Take care.
Bye now.
Bye, mate.
You know, a big old handful of Andys and a big old handful of Bobs and Bruces and Cossacks and Bennies and Roberts and the folks that call this program, we can fix it. It's the ignorant that are killing us. This is the Head On Radio Network. I'm Bob Kincaid. What you see is me. Big and black the clouds may be. Time will pass away. If you put your trust in me, I'll make bright your day.
Top of the.
This is the Quality News Network. A criminal investigation has been launched into the deaths of an Iraqi family by five U.S. soldiers. Officials say one of the dead was a child. Another was reportedly raped before the troops set her body on fire to destroy evidence. A U.S. official says at least one of the soldiers has admitted his role. In an audio tape released yesterday, Osama bin Laden praised al-Qaeda leader Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, who was killed earlier this month. Bin Laden vowed that al-Qaeda will continue fighting U.S. forces and their allies everywhere. In Washington, members of Congress say they will help President Bush find a way to handle the detainees at Guantanamo Bay Prison. Yesterday, the Supreme Court ruled that holding military tribunals goes against both U.S. and international law. In Gaza City, Egypt is reportedly trying to mediate a deal between the Israelis and Palestinians, but Israel denies it is cooperating in any negotiations and continues to demand the release of an abducted soldier. Meanwhile, thousands of protesters in Egypt are calling for a holy war in support of the Palestinians. USA Today has admitted that the NSA database is not as widespread as initially believed. The newspaper says it cannot confirm Verizon and Bell South provided records to the National Security Agency as previously reported. About 1,500 National Guard troops are now stationed at the U.S.-Mexico border. That's far short of the 2,500 President Bush had hoped for by the June 30th deadline. Border state officials say that number probably won't be reached until mid-July. In New York City, the former police commissioner has pleaded guilty to corruption charges. In a plea agreement, he'll avoid jail time but face more than $220,000 in fines. He'll also be able to keep his job as a security consultant in the Middle East. Across the Northeast, tens of thousands of residents are cleaning up after flooding forced them from their homes. At least 16 people were killed. Officials say damages could be as high as $100 million. State legislatures have passed a slew of new laws, some of which take effect tomorrow, others which take effect January 1st. For instance, South Carolina can now execute anyone convicted twice for raping children under the age of 11. In Memphis, Tennessee, today, President Bush and the First Lady toured Graceland, Elvis Presley's home, with Japan's Prime Minister. He leaves office in September. You're listening to the Quality News Network.
Divorce is never a pleasant experience, but it doesn't have to be a tragedy. If you can rein in the emotions, step back from the anger and victimhood, you can end your marriage with dignity instead of hostility. You married with the best of intentions. Now you need to untie the marital knot with the same mutual respect. Choose collaboration instead of confrontation. Stop wasting money on lawyers. Don't drag this out for 5 years. A collaborative divorce is better for the children, family, and friends. Collaboration costs a fraction of a contended divorce and can be done within weeks rather than the months or years. An award-winning documentary called Divorce Collaborative Style explains how you can end your marriage fairly and efficiently. For less than what a lawyer charges to answer one simple question, you can get all the answers from Divorce Collaborative Style. Go to collaborativedivorce.tv and order your DVD today. If it's over, end it right. collaborativedivorce.tv.
President Bush has nominated a Columbia University professor to serve in the Federal Reserve. On February 1st, Bush nominee Ben Bernanke took over as chair. The Commerce Department reports that consumer spending slowed in May. The government report blames rising gasoline prices. The FDA has approved a new drug to treat vision loss in the elderly. One analyst said Genentech's Lucentis could reach $1 billion in annual sales within 3 years. The FDA has also approved the first generic version of the antidepressant Zoloft. An Israeli pharmaceutical company plans to make the generic version of the drug. Apple Computer revealed irregularities related to stock options that its chief executive received between 1997 and 2001. More than 60 companies are reviewing their stock option grant policies. UPS and its pilots union have reached a tentative deal on a new contract that for some includes a more than 17% raise. The contract still must be ratified. Supermarket chain Ralph's is expected to plead guilty to charges stemming from a 2003 labor dispute in Southern California. Light sweet crude settled at $73.93 today. At the close of Wall Street this week, the Dow was down 41 points at 11,150. NASDAQ down 2 at 2172. S&P 500 down 3 at 1270. You can hear more at QualityNewsNetwork.com. I'm Kimberly White. It's now 5 minutes past the hour.
It's your second hour in the Liberal Sandbox, and you're head-on with Bob Kincaid.
I fear I'm guilty of being a little over-intellectual tonight, but I can't resist. My brain has been boiling for a few days now. And it's hard to get around. I mean, all kinds of weird ideas are hitting me. I heard in the car today on right-wing radio, Flush Flembaugh defending Anthrax Coulter, but at the same time talking about how lovable he was. And how anybody who knows him can't help but like him. Well, out of that, you know, I play golf. Hairball, yes, Agnes. Out of that, I play golf. Flush plays golf. I'm going to send the dude an email. Meet you on the links.
I don't think so.
You don't have to caddy, dear.
Am I hitting with your claw?
We're going to find out. Four! Yeah, only with the oversized driver. Okay, let's go straight to the phones. Mike is calling from Woodstock, New York. Welcome, Mike.
Hey, how you doing?
Doing well, you?
I'm having a good day. I just took the grease car out for a spin.
That's so cool.
But it's actually literally a grease car. There's some small leak coming from the second tank that holds the waste vegetable oil, somehow leaking into the floor in the back seat. But we're gonna figure it out.
Yeah, that's nasty because that even doesn't fall in line with the principle of British automotives that, you know, if there's no oil on the floor, there's no oil in the car.
There you go. This is a German mobile, but yeah.
Teutonic engineering.
Exactly. Let's see. I had a couple of things. I've been thinking about this issue of, like, who right-wingers are and who, like, left-wingers are and what this means. And I was actually – somebody shot a movie. It's a documentary about Woodstock, and they talked about the incredible polarization in this little town between people who originally lived here and newcomers and the left and the right and everything that exists here. And one thing that they had one character – and his whole thing was, no matter what people were for, he was always going to be against it. And because the majority of the people in Woodstock tended to be liberal, democratic, left-wing, revolutionary types, this guy was going to be the complete opposite. And this guy goes around with, you know, handmade signs that says, elect President Bush, and so on. And so, I really started thinking about this in a general issue. I think a lot of people are for Bush because they want to be different from the people who are against Bush. And it's not even about ideology or anything else other than that. What do you think, Bob? It's just a weird theory I got.
Well, no. Oh, well, I think that comes straight out of, what was it, the Marx Brothers movie, A Day at the Races?
Okay.
where Groucho sings that famous, wonderful song, whatever it is, whatever you're for, I'm against it?
Yeah, okay, that's it. It's like this curmudgeon attitude.
But it doesn't square with most of the American population, I don't think. I had the fortune or misfortune today when I went down to the hospital of parking sort of a diagonal away from a guy who I noticed had a W04 sticker on his big old SUV.
Oh, man.
And he was getting out and walking in at the same time I did. Now, I'm not overtly confrontational, but just walking in, we're walking next to each other. I said, that Bush vote, how's that working out for you? And he just looked at me and went, huh? I said, I saw your sticker, that Bush vote. How's that working out for you? And he said, what do you mean? I said, well, look around you. You did this. How's that working out for you?
It's a disconnect, Bob.
It was a complete disconnect, Mike.
There's a real disconnect going on, and I don't think people understand what they're doing.
But see, I can't talk about stuff like this on the air if I'm not willing to do it myself in real life.
Right, right.
And so I did. I was trying to engage the guy. I mean, I didn't want to stand and scream at him or anything, but he wouldn't engage.
Anybody, it's funny because right after the election, I saw a fair amount of Bush 04 stickers on the highways as I commuted between Woodstock and New York City. And then they've been disappearing slowly, but the few that have them, they are that 26% that support them.
They're that weird little cancerous knot of America.
Yeah, living in an illusion.
See, I think you didn't start listening to the program until fairly recently. I spent 2 months, April to June, in Alabama, and did the show from there every night.
Hardcore.
Very much. And, I mean, that's where I grew up. But I paid attention as I drove around town because I figured I was in the belly of the beast. If I'm going to go somewhere and just see a steady traffic line of nothing but George Bush stickers still in 2006, I'm going to see it in Alabama. They weren't there, Mike.
You're a white Southerner, then, I guess you're saying.
I'm not white. I'm pink, okay? I mean, I burn under the refrigerator lamp.
Because, I mean, I think there are progressive Southerners out there, but I tell you, our perception up here in the Northeast of the Southerners is that they're solidly behind Bush, but I think that's a misconception.
And I think we've got to break that idea. I wouldn't criticize you for that, Mike, because that is what you've been taught to believe.
I mean, the total hypocrisy, of course, is the racism and the redneck factor up here is probably equal to anywhere in upstate New York.
Most likely. I mean, that's one of the reasons I so love a band out of my own hometown called the Drive-By Truckers. Because they have taken that, they've completely deconstructed it. If you get your hands on a disc or an album called Southern Rock Opera.
I've heard of Drive-By Truckers. They're doing very well on the indie level, aren't they?
Oh, very well. Very well. I mean, they're huge.
Okay.
But they on Southern Rock Opera, they completely deconstruct Southern redneckism. And it goes so far, one night I heard Mike Malloy make a comment about Lynyrd Skynyrd, just sort of off the cuff. And he was immediately deluged by Southern liberals writing in going, Lynyrd Skynyrd was no racist, white, Southern redneck band.
Right. All that stuff between them and Neil Young was in jest. They were all friends.
Well, yeah. And if you listen to any of the lyrics, you realize that, they were counterculture. And yet they got a whole bunch of people with Confederate flags in the back of their trucks to listen to them and go, hell yeah. So I'm really gratified to hear you say, Mike, or acknowledge that there is that attitude in the North. And, a lot of this stuff goes back to the Civil War. I'm sorry, but it does.
Well, we had up here what we called de facto segregation. And it was...
Right. Nobody passed a law, but that's just how it was?
That's just how it was. The blacks lived here. The whites lived here. I grew up in a segregated town in Connecticut. And I saw the first black person when I was 4 years old, and I bet you in the South nobody could say that.
Oh, no, 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 no. And see, that's one of the, but see, there's another side of that coin, Mike, and that is, and that's the reasoning behind a whole bunch of Southern racist senators and congressmen rising up to oppose the Voting Rights Act. It's and their reasoning goes like this. It's no fair that you continue to hammer on the South when you're every bit as racist in the North. Why can't we look at voting rights in Darien, Connecticut?
Well, but that's not true. The Voting Rights Act applies to everyone.
It does.
And it was raised to
there is a monitoring element of the Voting Rights Act that is aimed squarely at the South because there's an element of the Voting Rights Act that says never again.
Well, you know, then the Voting Rights Act needs to come and rescue us in New York and in Georgia and in Maine and in Ohio and in Florida and in Minnesota. We need to be rescued by the Voting Rights Act. We need to be monitored.
Well, if you're going to do anything with the Voting Rights Act, and we've got till 2007 to do something about it, if you're going to do anything about it, Mike, you got to put more teeth in it. Because when and we know this now. I mean, you know this. I know this. It hasn't filtered down to the guy with the Bush 2004 sticker on the back of his SUV yet, but it will. When 350,000 people who are predominantly African American have their ballots just chucked out in the out the window in Ohio in 2004, that is evidence to me that the focus needs to continue to be on the South, but it needs to be broadened.
Are you sure about that figure? 350,000 African Americans? You're not talking about total voters, are you?
I'm going. I could possibly be a little bit screwed up, but it's 350,000 votes, and it is primarily minority voters, and it is Ohio, and it's 2004, and it was enough to turn the election for Kerry.
Well, yeah. All right. I had another thing I want to talk about. You guys were talking about alternative energy earlier. Two things. One, I have a creek in my backyard, as you know, that just was raging.
It was a torrent recently.
Yeah, it was crazy. It did a lot of damage. Not to my house, but to the geography around here. But I would love to put a water turbine back there, and I could generate enough electricity for my house, but it's illegal. I can't do it.
Yeah, because it is stream modification, I would imagine, under the laws of the state of New York.
That is water protected by the watershed. But I don't know, in this day and age with our energy crisis, why we couldn't have, you know, water generators just for our personal use. But that's just, you know, I just think that's politics.
Well, that's that falls under the subheading of something, at least in law school, that they refer to as riparian rights. And, you know, if you live by a river, you can't dam the river downstream.
Right.
But if you can leave almost zero footprint, and they exist, I mean, you can find them online. There are turbines inside pipes,
exactly.
and you lay them in your creek, and boom, power.
Exactly, and I'm going to look into that. I mean, the other thing is I could just go underground and just do that and run a wire back to my house, but eventually the electricity company would put a stop to it. The other thing that I'm researching now is a diesel generator that what it does is it charges up batteries. I live in a fairly small house. It's about 900 square feet, and I have a wood-burning stove and so on, so I probably could heat. I could probably totally power my house with a diesel generator, the same kind that truckers use.
Yeah.
And, you know, then I was thinking, you know, it basically has to run 2 to 4 hours a day to charge the batteries. And then you could run that off of WVO, which is waste vegetable oil, if you could modify that diesel engine. So I've been looking at various ways to get off the grid.
And it's not that great a leap.
It's not. It takes some money and it takes some work.
But work is born of energy, and energy you obviously have. And I'm talking about intellectual energy and physical. Strong back, weak mind energy.
Well, you know, I'm lucky because I have the misfortune. I have the fortune to be able to work at home, and so I have time to research these things.
Well, you know, Mike, I hope you can succeed with these things, and I hope you can report back with them. I hope that by reporting back, that you can empower others to do it.
I would be happy to do that and share information as I receive it. I appreciate your time. I really like your show. I hope there's some listeners out there and that you can get some sponsors eventually, although I do like your PSAs about divorce.
That's cool. That's the news network running, and I think at some point we're going to have to find somebody to talk about that during one of the programs, because I've had a couple of questions about what collaborative divorce means.
Well, that's cool. And the other thing is, I'll put out there is at some point in the future, maybe we'll talk about me helping you doing some internet marketing to get this thing going.
That would be wonderful. You know, we're I'm not going to say communist or anything, but this is a labor of love. And if this thing is happening, it's happening because there are people dedicated to bringing a conversation to America.
Very good. Have an excellent night. I'm going to keep listening.
All right. Thank you, Mike, and you have an excellent weekend.
Bye-bye.
Take care. And shooting right along, let's go to Jim. Hey, Jim, welcome to the program.
Yeah, seeing you and Rush Limbaugh on the links would be something I would pay to see.
Now, see, I knew there'd be somebody. I knew there'd be a taker out there somewhere.
I would pay to see that. I would pay good money to see that. See, he would wrap which club around which part of whose anatomy.
Yeah, but see, this, Jim, this goes back to something I read some years ago, and it was some golf aficionado writing, and he said, "I can't imagine any place on earth where you could sit Willie Nelson and Richard Nixon down and have them get along." But if you put them on a golf course,
I don't think that. I think one person would come back. I don't know. But anyway, moving on. Someone sent Rush Limbaugh a licensed sex therapist an email, and it was on the Guy James show, and she was referencing certain of his predilections and very specific things like having been married three times, and then some partner of his who was very close. In California, passing away with AIDS.
Well, you see, very few people know, Jim, that.
And then his proclivities, perhaps for the Dominican Republic sex trade. And,
well, he's already said it was a boys' trip only.
Well, it was pretty. It was. I have never heard such a thing in my life, and I hear a cat in the background. Is that your cat?
Yeah, that's ISIS.
Oh, okay. But it was very, very, very interesting, and I wish I could get a copy of it because it was absolutely eviscerating.
Well, see, what when I was listening to Rush this afternoon, and I do, he was complaining about, no liberals listen to me.
I can't listen to him.
Well, I did. Okay, I mean, it's the only game in town. It's that or I have to listen to the Eagles doing one of these nights for the 9,276,433rd time. And I can't do it anymore because, I've got my own little iPod in my brain. I know what one of these nights sounds like. But where Rush is concerned, he had just taken a call from a guy who said, "I'm a Democrat, but I'm not a liberal." What a wimp. What he said was, 90% of this program is satire. And the thing is, the liberals had gotten so used to having power that they couldn't imagine that anyone would make fun of them. Jim, you would know, who was the guy who did such a masterful job prior to the Kennedy assassination making light of John Kennedy? Do you remember who I'm talking about?
Von Meter.
Von Meter, exactly.
First Family album.
And that was brilliant. And I would guess that constitutes making fun of a liberal.
Well, I don't know. I remember listening to that when I was in high school, and then all of a sudden one day it just wasn't popular anymore.
It wasn't funny anymore.
No, it wasn't. And the second thing is today's CNN's coverage of Bush at Graceland.
Oh, I know. Weren't you just embarrassed?
Been to Graceland or not?
I have. Oh man, I grew up 125 miles from Graceland. I've been to Graceland.
Well, when I saw that place, I had to go to see an ophthalmologist after having seen the decor of that house.
Elvis was a country boy, and he was a country boy until the day he died on the toilet.
Well, it would not be in the Architectural Digest, but the look at that Japanese premier or whoever he is who had his hair done like Elvis.
Oh, yeah.
And him and Bush cavorting around the dining room and they had the thing in a loop, and it was almost in a speeded frame. It looked like something out of a Max Sennett comedy.
Well, I guess you could take it that way, Jim, but I took it a different way.
You saw it?
Yeah.
It was just...
No, look, I was in the hospital room with my dad. We do CNN, me and my dad, when we're not doing Law and Order. But, no, I saw it in a different light because... Junichiro Koizumi is a child of Elvis, if you get right down to it. And that Elvis had more of an impact on Junichiro Koizumi than George Bush will ever dream of having. And when you think about what Elvis did for the rest of the world, and I'm not talking about, you know, didn't bring world peace or nothing, but he...
Oh, he has wonderful music. I'm just
but no. He changed attitudes.
I'm just talking
between Elvis and the Beatles. We're talking about a massive worldwide attitude change that was caused outside politics, and that was kind of cool to me. Now, if you want to get down to what sort of got under my skin, it was the tagline to one of the reports that said, "And aboard Air Force One, Prime Minister Koizumi and President Bush were served one of Elvis's favorite treats, fried peanut butter and banana sandwiches." You know, first of all...
You mean the Fusco sandwich?
First of all, I'm a redneck. That ain't fried. That's grilled. Okay? It's a grilled peanut butter and banana sandwich. I was eating them before I knew Elvis liked them. Yeah, they serve them at Trowbridge's at the north end of Court Street in Florence, Alabama.
They do?
Oh yeah, it's not an Elvis treat. It's a Deep South treat.
I've never seen such a thing.
Oh, they're exquisite, Jim. They are. They're the most wonderful thing in the world. Two slices of white bread grilled in butter, with a little tiny smear of mayonnaise and some peanut butter and banana in the middle. The yummiest thing you ever ate in your life.
I will leave that. Let me put it this way. You can have my share. Okay?
Jim, do not shuffle off this mortal coil without a grilled peanut butter and banana sandwich.
Well, anyway, I thought it was strange that they took Air Force One down there like that. Now,
I think it's offensive.
How much it cost and this, that, and the other, just for... And then they gave the guy a jukebox filled with Elvis records or CDs or something like that. And I thought to myself, you know, this is... But see,
Jim, this shows what a fake redneck Bush is.
The body language of these people was what impressed me on the CNN coverage of it, and I just thought it was kind of ridiculous.
Well, it was in a way, but I come away because there's, as Americans, Jim, you and I can never comprehend what Elvis was to the rest of the world, or what the Beatles were. Elvis was a redefining of America, when you get right down to it. And you know, but
well, yes, I've never really thought about him that much.
Well, see, it's a secret I tell only. Well, okay, now I'm telling everybody. The same guy that discovered Elvis used to sign my paychecks, Sam Phillips. And you know, I got to talk with Sam a little bit. And he talked about how important Elvis and Johnny Cash and Carl Perkins and Jerry Lee Lewis, how important they were, not to America, but to the world, and what they meant to the world in terms of what America was. And I believe it to be true that they showed, you know, when...
I defer to you on that, certainly.
But following the Second World War... Elvis and John Cash and Jerry Lee Lewis and Carl Perkins represented something beyond the reconstruction of the world following the war. They represented a cultural freeness. If the United States will allow Elvis Presley to do that with his hips on TV, then there's a new dawn of freedom around the world. And I know that seems like a big leap, but it really was.
Okay, like I say, if you say so, I defer to you on that because I just never had that much experience with that, actually.
Well, it was, you know, so I can understand Junichiro Koizumi wanting to go there. I could understand Hosni Mubarak wanting to go there.
The only reason I went there was just to see exactly what was there, because I had heard so many things about it, and I was just, I mean, you know, my tongue was just, I mean, my eyeballs were just popping out of my head. I couldn't believe what I saw. And, you know, it's just... it was quite an experience, I recommend it highly for anyone. You know.
Yeah. Really. Now, see, I would have liked it. I would have gotten. It would have been one of the few times that I've ever endorsed George Bush. But if I saw a press release from the White House saying, not that they were going to spend a fortune on Air Force One, but that, you know, they were getting it. They were getting on George's Cadillac Escalade or whatever it is that he drives around in, and they were going to make a road trip to Graceland. You know, for once in my life, I would have been down with George Bush on that. Because, you know, you put a bunch of long neck ice cold something or another's in an ice chest, and you go to Graceland and you play in the music, and it's a pilgrimage.
It's what?
It's a pilgrimage.
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear you.
I said it's a pilgrimage.
A pilgrim.
Yeah.
Okay.
But you know, when you load up your 747 to go to Graceland, it's a little embarrassing.
Agree. Well, that's all I have.
All right, Jim. Thank you very much. Good to talk to you, brother.
You too. Bye-bye, man.
Have a great weekend now. Bye now. And, Agnes, do we go to a break? Okay, quick break, and then we come back to your phone calls. If you're on hold, please stay that way. We'll go right back to the phones, I promise. This is the Head On Radio Network. I'm Bob Kincaid. Not just anybody. Help. You know I need someone. So much younger than today. I never needed anybody's help in any way. But now these days are gone, I'm not so self-assured. Now I find I've changed my mind and opened up the doors. Help me if you can, I'm feeling down. And I do appreciate you being right.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham.
And I'm Jesse Russell.
The AFL-CIO is leading a protest today against high gasoline prices at the White House. Joss Williams, president of the Washington, D.C. area, AFL-CIO, says working families are being hit hard by the high prices as oil companies gouge record profits.
What we are saying to the Bush administration is that those people who put them in office, big oil barons, their days should come to an end. And this administration should be about people, not about profit.
Williams says that higher crude prices alone do not account for the increased oil company profits, and he would like to see the Bush administration end tax incentives for big oil.
The battle over a federal minimum wage increase may not be over as Democrats in the Senate have drawn a line in the sand. Led by Senate Minority Leader Harry Reid, the Democrats are vowing to block an approved congressional pay hike scheduled for January 1st unless the Republican majority agrees to an increase in the minimum wage for the country's lowest paid workers. The minimum wage has not increased in nearly a decade, while in that time congressional salaries have blossomed by more than $30,000. The congressional salary is currently $165,200 annually, with an increase of $3,300 scheduled for January 1st. A person working full-time at minimum wage earns $10,712 per year. At $5.15 per hour, the average minimum wage earner would have to work nonstop for more than 3 years to match the congressional salary. Only 21 states have a wage higher than the federal minimum.
It's official. Oregon has a brand new Working Families Party. Barbara Dudley is a Working Families Party organizer.
We're going to be focusing on family wage jobs, on getting living wages paid for all kinds of work in this country, for things like universal and affordable health care, for adequate funding for public education. We want to get public education all through higher education accessible to working class kids again.
Dudley says the party will be active in the November elections and will hold a founding convention this summer.
The FBI says a laptop containing the personal information of nearly 26.5 million veterans has been recovered, and there is no evidence of tampering. The Bureau has not said how the laptop was recovered or if any arrests have been made.
Here's today's economic report. According to the Economic Policy Institute, U.S. economic productivity is up 14.7% and profits are way up. But for working families, wages and incomes are actually down below where they were at the start of the recovery in 2001. EPI says wage growth has been shortchanged because 46% of the total corporate income growth has been distributed as corporate profits. As a result, real median household income has fallen 5 years in a row. You've been listening to WIN, Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Should I say, 25 minutes before the hour, we're halfway through this Friday night edition of Head On. I'm Bob Kincaid. And by the way, before we go back to the phones, and I promised and I will, if you're wondering why it's all Beatles tonight, well, you know, I have never had an urge in my life to go to Las Vegas. Las Vegas holds absolutely no fascination for me whatsoever. I want a poker game. I got some good buddies. I can make a couple of phone calls. We'll have a hell of a good poker game. But premiering in Vegas, the new Cirque du Soleil show called Love. And it's all done to the music of the Beatles. And it was all put together by George Martin. The one time in my life I'd like to be in Vegas. So, hence the Beatles. Let's go to the phones. David is with us from Middle Tennessee. Hey, David. Oh, David. David. Okay. David, are you with us? Well, doggone it. Bob in North Dakota. Hey, Bob. Welcome to the program.
Hello. Hello, buddy.
Hey, how you doing?
I miss you.
Missed you, too.
I just got to say something about that young officer that came on and told the truth to Bruce.
Yeah, Lieutenant Colonel Swift?
Yeah, he's just a young lieutenant colonel. Now, he wasn't no admiral, or he wasn't no general.
No.
He was just a young lieutenant colonel that told the truth. And I told Bruce, I said, you know, I would follow that man into battle, Bob, but you, yeah? He said the truth. He just stood up and he just said.
Well, and I think that's one of the reasons this ruling came out the way it did, although the ruling was a long way from what it needed to be. The military lawyers who were assigned to defend these people were saying we can't get a fair trial. And when a JAG tells you he can't get a fair trial, holy cow.
Yeah, yeah. Isn't that funny, huh? In this day and age, we got so many people that just think that, whatever. I heard something about these people. Oh, my God, Bob. I'm so sick of these people. I had a guy over here today. His name is Larry Wilson, and I gave him a boat.
Yeah?
I gave him a boat. It was an old boat, and it was beat up. My son said, Dad, just, hey, give it to him. I'm tired of it. And, you know, the kids, they done been out on the big lake, and they got their butt beat on the thing. He says, just give it to him, Dad. Get rid of it, and I gave it to him.
That's cool.
No, it wasn't cool, Bob.
No, that's a good thing to do. Yeah, I mean, you know, let's not quibble over semantics. That was a cool thing for you to do.
No, it wasn't cool. I gave away a piece of junk to a man that thought I gave him the pearls to the kingdom, or maybe the...
One man's nightshirt, Bob.
Or the keys to the Queen Mary. It was something special to him. One man's junk is another man's treasure. Yeah?
Yeah.
And to me it was junk, and to him it was treasure. And I made a friend, Bob. I made a friend. A friend.
Yes.
This is my good friend, Bob. Because I'm not a good friend. I'm just a friend, Bob. I'm not a good friend. I'm just another friend.
No, not at all.
Yes.
No, I'm not. No, let's not quibble.
All right. Let's not quibble. Okay? I may try to, kind of enhance your kingdom for you, but it's not a kingdom because you're not a king, but you are my friend. And you do what you do because you do it, because you're honest and you have nothing other than honesty in you. And that's what I love about you.
Well, thank you, Bob.
No, it is honesty. You do not lie. You might make a mistake every now and then, and then every time you do make a mistake, you come back on the air and say, whoop, I made a mistake, right?
No, I don't think so.
No, you come back when you do say something in error. I've heard you say it. Yeah, well, I...
Oh, no, if I screw up, I say so, because screwing up is one of the things I do best.
Yeah, well, we all do. Yeah, but the thing is, you admit your errors. You always admit them, Bob. You always have, and that's...
Well, I kind of have to. It's hardwired.
Well, yeah, I didn't say my other, I said hardwired my butt, because it is not hardwired. It just is. If you know you've done wrong, you always admit doing wrong. And I've done some wrong. I got bad on people. And Peter Godbold has to know that I am, I really am, I really do. I like the guy.
Well, we're all family here, okay? I mean, we're family. I mean,
but he's mad at me.
No, nobody's mad at you, Bob.
No. He is.
No, he's not.
Okay. Well, I got kind of tough on him, and I just want Peter to know that I'm not vengeful.
Well, good. I mean, I'm glad. But Bob, I don't know that this is the stuff that we want to be doing on air.
Oh, well, we got to do it on air because...
No, we don't. No, because... Oh. This has to do with stuff relating to the chat room and stuff like that, and I don't want to do it on air, okay? In fact, I expressly refuse to do it on air.
My fault. I just want to apologize.
Well, very well, but, I don't necessarily know that one was owed.
Okay, Bob, how can I apologize to Peter and say,
Well, I think you just did.
Well, I hope I can make amends and say, okay, I was a bad boy, and, Bob, you've done it many times, and apologize to lots of people. And I want to tell Peter that I apologize. I went after a guy that, he wasn't my friend, but, hey, he wasn't anybody's friend. He was his own friend, okay? And... Agnes knows what I'm talking about.
I know what you're talking about. I just don't necessarily want to talk about it on the air.
I know, but people have to hear that I apologize because I'm talking to Nan, I'm talking to TSM, I'm talking to all my friends out there.
Yeah.
Of you people. I really do.
We're building community here, Bob.
I know you are, and I want to be part of it, but I can't be part of it if I'm... what do you call it, band? I'd like to be part of the community, Bob. I don't want to hurt anyone. I did hurt somebody. I don't know how I hurt them, but I apologize, and I apologize to Jim. I apologize to Wayne. Hey, Wayne, I haven't heard him for a while. He should call in.
He's been a busy man.
Huh?
He's been a busy man.
Good for him. And
he burned up his vacation putting together his son's wedding.
Ah.
And his son and daughter-in-law's wedding.
I think
he's in the middle of a well-deserved rest right now.
Bob, we're talking family.
Yeah, we are.
Yes, and hey, my love to your dad. Oh, God, I love that man. I would love him. Side by side.
Yeah, you would have loved him even now, laying in a hospital bed, he's great company.
Even in the hospital bed, he's great company.
He's charmed an entire hospital floor, okay?
I wouldn't doubt it. He's probably got nurses. Good damn.
Oh, he's diabetic, and he says, I want grape juice, and they bring him grape juice, and they don't think a word thing about his diabetes. I mean, you know.
Them good girls, aren't they?
And men.
Yeah, and lots of Mark. And, hey, your lady is a good girl. And
look, you know, I mean, Bob, we're trying really, really hard to build something special here.
And
you're a big part of it. And so is everyone in the chat room. I mean, there are people in the chat room I've never heard from on the phone.
Good.
But you know, it's a matter of sharing time, Bob.
Yes.
Because how many times have you heard somebody say, "Well, you know, I'll get around to that quick as I get time."
Nope.
There ain't no more time. You ain't gonna get any of it. You either do it or you don't do it. and so consequently, when people choose to spend their time with the Head On Radio Network. My God,
I do love you.
That's more highly priced than gold.
Hey, guess what?
What's that?
You ain't down dark deep in the hole.
Nope. Long as I can claw my way to daylight, it's another good day.
Yeah, and that's what the boys in them coal mines do every doggone day of the week. And you know, you people. You know, you, Agnes, your chillin', and your pappy, you just try to bring them boys back up into the light. And I love you for it, because you're trying to bring me and my people back up into the light. And I say, just bring my country back to me. The country that loves, cares for, and takes care of its own chillin'. Its own people, like you take care of your own killing. And that Agnes, goodness gracious, she's a good girl.
Well, she got done producing John last night, and she looked at me and said, "My butt's numb." She said, "I've been sitting in this chair for 9 hours," and she had been.
Yeah.
But you know, this is the kind. You know.
You and me.
Well, I mean, yeah. Did you ever play sports growing up, Bob?
Bob, if you and me were sitting on the front porch, you know what we'd be speaking? You know, you and I'd be speaking. We'd be speaking the same dang language. The same. No, it ain't English. It ain't Arabic. It ain't nothing else. It'd be the same dang language.
Well, sometimes it's the language of quiet, Bob. You know,
yep.
I was sitting out the other night. Oh God, I'm going to get philosophical. I was sitting out the other night, and I realized that at a certain distance, fireflies and meteorites look the same.
Yep.
In the night sky.
Yep, they do. And it's all just
a question of perspective, Bob.
Yeah. You know what else is the same? It's the language of love. It just is. If you love, you love. If you hate, you hate. But, hey, people, you know, old Gunny Bob up here in North Dakota, I love you all. Sometimes I get a little testy and a little crusty, but I love you all. It doesn't matter whether you're gay, bisexual, heterosexual, or whatever. I get down and I speak my mind, and sometimes I get a little crusty. So forgive me if I offend, but I love you all. And I do love your dear Agnes. She, hey, I would love to have her speak to Glenda, because Glenda missed her, and Glenda thinks, hey, you know, she thinks the world of dear Agnes. And you know what, Bobby? I think the world of you, because you and me on a fire line, we'd stand out. We would stand up, and we would fight back.
Well, you know, I just read a couple of messages out of the chat room, and a couple of people just GMR366 just said, "We love you too, Gunny."
Yeah, well,
we got to roll though, brother.
Love you, people. I love you all. And hey, speak to Pete. Okay.
Gonna do it. All right, take care, brother. We'll talk to you soon. Have a wonderful weekend.
Hey, fourth is not the beginning. Not the end, it's the beginning of the end. It's the beginning of the end of the Bush administration. For us, for our children, for our children's children, we have to take it back. Just out of love, not out of hate, but for love of nation, love of people, love of the world, we will take it back if we can stand up and do it. And thank you, Bobby.
All right. Take care, Bob. Wonderful weekend. Thank you for your thoughts.
Night, night to you.
Later now.
Bye.
And rolling on to David in Middle Tennessee. Hey, David, welcome back.
Well, thank you, Bob. Sorry about the, you know, I had to drop off because, well, the one battery for the phone wasn't charged properly.
Oh, I thought your peanut butter and banana sandwich was burning.
No, I've never quite gotten into that because I'm sorry. Peanut butter for me is an after 11 o'clock at night out of the jar with a spoon with the Blackberry, well, Bama brand.
Bama brand. And all God's children said amen.
Bama brand, you know, a spoon of one, a spoon of the other, you know, savor. More of the Pabst Blue Ribbon out of the 16-ouncer, and then get back to the peanut butter.
I guess that's a little bit of a geographical difference, David, and a little bit of my weirdness. As a child growing up, I would not eat white bread. I would not do it. It was just icky to me, and it was the dedication of my mother. Anybody, okay. Try it. Slice a banana in two, and try to spread peanut butter on a banana. And put the banana. It ain't easy, but she got me into grilled cheeses, and then it was the grilled peanut butter and banana sandwich, and life ain't never been the same since.
That first statement about spreading that stuff on a banana, Bob, that's illegal in three other states.
You're right.
Speaking about understanding Southern understanding.
West Tennessee, Northwest Alabama, and Northeast Mississippi, brother.
If you say so. I'm sorry. Folks in my part of the South ain't cooking with no peanut butter. That is something for somebody else.
And, you know, I think that's why I loved it so much the first time I walked into a Thai restaurant. They're cooking with peanut butter. It ain't going to get no better.
They're cooking with ground peanut initially. There's a difference. We'll talk about that later off here. Let's talk about Yankees understanding us.
Okay.
Just to put a firewall between peanut butter and the rest.
And I don't think Mike was being derogatory calling from Woodstock. I mean, that was an outreach call, man.
Oh, the only reason I said Yankees was to put your brakes on. And I wanted to make sure there was a firewall. I don't say Yankees in a derogatory sense. Let's talk about Northerners or anybody that isn't Southern, because I wanted to tap into a little story that is first person and very much a part of what I'm about. I met this lovely woman, and we became interested in each other, and we chose to live with each other. And one night in Portland, Oregon, after a couple of glasses of wine on her end, which, you know, based on a woman that weighed 105 pounds, was a bunch of alcohol, I suddenly had to hear about, you're such a nice man, but you're from that part of the world that does those horrible things to people of color. And so I got a lot more sober really quick because I went, wait a second, I never expected to hear this kind of thing.
That wasn't on the agenda for the date.
No, it had never been there before. There had been several other things on the agenda, but never that. But it was, you know, it was down on the list, but by golly, it had a couple of stars beside it. And we talked a little further, and finally, after surveying the lay of the land, being the counterpuncher that I am, I said, so help me understand this. Now, we Southerners are those bad guys, you know, generally speaking. Help me understand what you understand and what you really know firsthand about people of color. Tell me about all of the people of color in your high school. And she says, well, he was a great guy.
I'm sorry, I shouldn't laugh.
Well, you probably know where this story is going. She had gone to high school 6 years after me, so that means she graduated in 1967, and there was a black exchange student from some African country, and his father had been brought to the United States to work for a precursor to the high-tech revolution that surrounded Beaverton, Oregon. And she couldn't understand, based on the fact that she had been in high school with a black kid, why we were, quote, the way we were. And I said, you know what? You really don't have anything to talk about because we begin to experience black people at birth. We begin to experience what our culture has done with and to and for black people at birth. And that exposure never stops, ever, because 20% of the town I grew up in was black people. I said, talk to me about the percentage of people in Beaverton, Oregon that are black people. She didn't want to talk about the percentage. She wanted to talk about the number. You know, like 218 out of 32,000.
Well, and see, there's a significant amount of that, and this is a southern state, West Virginia is, whether people want to admit it or not. It is, yeah, okay, we seceded from the secessionists, but it's below the Mason-Dixie line.
Well, you know.
And this has been a state that has, in its past, worked really hard to keep itself lily white. Unless, of course, the coal company bosses needed to bring in some strike breakers, in which case they brought in Eastern Europeans, Italians. They brought in African Americans. But, you know, one of the things that makes me proud of this state, David, is the fact that when the UMWA came here and started trying to organize, it was organized from day one as an integrated union. And, in fact, the father of Black History Month started as a UMWA member not 10 miles from where I sit right now.
And that's just the way it should be, and I'm thrilled to hear that story. But there's this little bit of misunderstanding, and I don't say that, you know, the woman in my life was wrong or right, and neither do I say I'm wrong or right, but there's this level of inexperience. I don't want to throw out the word ignorance. I don't want to throw that out there. But there's this level of inexperience. She had no, and so many others, had no understanding of how much interaction a Southerner has had, typically, with black people. One of the best ways for most Southerners to realize that segregation was a big mistake was to tap in what had happened to them in the previous 18 to 25 years prior to voting, prior to exerting their opinion on the rest of the community or offering it. And if you really tapped into what had happened to you as an individual, you were willing to say, wait a second, you know, that top-down stuff about they've got to be suppressed, we've got to be on top, you know, that's really stupid. And we learned that by being around other people other than ourselves, I should say.
See, well, David, and we're Would it offend you if I asked you to hold over through the news break?
No.
Because I want to go other places with you too.
It's not very important to me a few minutes ago. You said something about Sam Phillips, and that couple of buttons right there.
Yeah. But see, you're a generation ahead of me, man.
Yes.
I started school in Florence, Alabama, right after the marches had been had in the streets, and the white flight had started, and the white Christian churches had started their own schools to save their little white children from the Negroes.
Well,
and my parents were emigres. They had come from West Virginia.
Well,
I started in the public school system, David. And I started with young African American children, as if to me, hell, they're with me in first grade.
Not in my
case. No, not in your case, but in my case. So I'd like to continue this discussion if we may. We've got to do the news right now, so let me ask Agnes to please put you back on hold, and we will continue this discussion coming out of the news break. Is that okay?
I'm on for the ride.
All right. Thank you so much. News is on the way. This is Head On. I'm Bob Kincaid.
Has admitted his role in the attack. In Gaza City, Palestinian militants say the Israeli soldier they're holding hostage will only be released if Israel releases 1,000 prisoners and stops its assault. That casts doubt on a diplomatic resolution. Egypt is reportedly trying to broker a deal with Syria, which reportedly has closer ties to the abductors than the Hamas-led government. A new internet posting says Osama bin Laden is about to issue a message about Somalia and Iraq. That comes one day after the release of a new audio tape from bin Laden in which he praises slain al-Qaeda leader Abu Musab al-Zarqawi. He also vows al-Qaeda's fight will continue against U.S. forces and its allies. In the audio, bin Laden also demands the release of Zarqawi's body to his family and that Jordan allow it to be buried there. But ABC News reports that Iraqi officials have already buried his remains, quote, in accordance with Muslim customs and traditions. Tomorrow, Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki will begin a tour of the Gulf states. He'll make stops in Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, and Kuwait to try to drum up support for his national reconciliation plan. In Afghanistan, coalition forces have reportedly tracked down and killed 14 militants armed with assault rifles and grenades. A statement from the coalition reported that there were no civilian or coalition deaths. The United States is insisting that Iran respond to the Western incentives offer to halt its nuclear program by July 5th, but Iranian officials insist they need more time to mull it over. A Western diplomat says that if they don't reply by the deadline, the UN Security Council will take action. As of today, about 1,500 National Guard troops are stationed at the U.S.-Mexico border, but that's far short of President Bush's goal of 2,500 by today. Officials say that number could be reached by mid-July. In New York City, the former police commissioner has pleaded guilty to corruption charges. In an agreement with prosecutors, he'll avoid jail time but face more than $220,000 in fines. You're listening to the Quality News Network. It's now 2.5 minutes past the hour. Business news is next.
In addition to producing and distributing the finest hourly newscasts in the country, the Quality News Network conducts interviews with 2006 candidates. We afford congressional and gubernatorial challengers of every political stripe the opportunity to illuminate their views and to demonstrate their character in a 20-minute network-quality interview. We perform this public service to enable voters to get a better listen to the people they might consider electing to high office. Because as Thomas Jefferson said, if a nation expects to be ignorant and free in a state of civilization, it expects what never was and never will be. If you want to know more about who is running in the November elections, go to qualitynewsnetwork.com and click on 2006 candidates. If we are to get America back on track, we need to elect people who can lead us in the right direction. Now, back to the news.
A Medicaid rule that goes into effect tomorrow requires that people prove they're citizens before applying for benefits. President Bush has nominated a Columbia University professor to serve in the Federal Reserve. Mr. Bush recently appointed Ben Bernanke to chair the agency after former Chief Alan Greenspan retired. The Commerce Department says consumer spending slowed in May due to high gas prices. Last month, consumer spending rose by only 0.4%. The FDA has approved a new drug to treat vision loss in the elderly. One analyst at Genentech's Lucentis could reach $1 billion in annual sales within 3 years. The FDA has also approved the first generic version of the antidepressant Zoloft. An Israeli pharmaceutical company plans to make the generic version of the Pfizer drug. Supermarket chain Whole Foods plans to support locally grown food to the tune of $10 million. The company's CEO says small farms can apply for long-term, low-interest loans to boost production. Microsoft says it will cut 214 positions from its sales force to boost its competitiveness. That amounts to about 5% of its sales force. Light sweet crude settled at $73.93 today. At the close of Wall Street this week, the Dow was down 41 points at 11,150. NASDAQ down 2 points at 2172. S&P 500 down 3 at 1270. You can hear more at qualitynewsnetwork.com. I'm Kimberly White. It's 5 minutes past the hour.
Tonight's final hour of Head On begins now. 1-877-4-HEAD-ON. That's 1-877-443-2366. Here's Buck.
Welcome back. 6 minutes after the hour. I'm Bob, and we rejoin our conversation, Broken in Progress, with David from Middle Tennessee. You still there, David? David?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, there you are. Okay. Don't scare me like that.
Oh, Bob, a little technicality. When I heard you before I heard the crunch to bring me back online, your voice was clear and crisp and, you know, like a very high-priced phone call. And now then, there's two stocks on your microphone, and you're way fuzzy.
Huh.
We'll work with it.
Okay.
You know, that's for another time, another day.
Good, because we don't have it tonight.
I can understand every word, fuzz or no fuzz.
Well, good deal. We were trying to sort out, how should we put it? The Southern experience versus the Northern experience. And I wanted to share something with you if I could, please. Because, you know, I was going down to the hospital today. I pick up a newspaper and take it to my dad. And we all know that I've just love the letters to the editor.
Oh, it's the best part of any newspaper.
And back on June the 20th, I remarked, as apparently did the Charleston Gazette, that June the 20th, Statehood Day for West Virginia, marks a blow against racism and a blow against landed gentry and a blow against autocracy and, you know, everything that the Old Dominion represented, you know, Old Virginia.
Okay.
So I open up the paper today, and I read this letter to the editor, and I want to share a little bit of it with you. It says, Editor,
The Gazette's potpourri on State Day portraying West Virginia as righteous and Virginia as rebellious and slaveholding, paren, a pharisaical attempt at moral superiority, was loaded with erroneous Yankee propaganda. Historical context is everything and is directly relevant to the Lincolnian War on Terrorism and federal usurpation of the Constitution. It was the Yankee North that rebelled against the Constitution, violating its slave law and Tenth Amendment provisions, revolutionizing Christian society for communist socialism, unlawfully invading the southern states, overthrowing the legitimate federal government of limited and delegated powers for a national consolidated and absolute one, forcing a tyrannical union at gunpoint. Honest to God, I would have been hard-pressed to believe in 2006, David, that I would have even read that in a paper in Broke-Knee, Georgia.
I would have been frightened to have read that coming out of Coeur d'Alene, Idaho.
The southern states did not commit insurrection, as terrorist abolitionists like John Brown did, but lawfully seceded, and were forced to resist with arms in self-defense against Yankee insurgency under the exact same justification as the American War for Independence against King George's England.
There is only one way that as an accredited card-carrying newspaper editor with any sort of credential to do said job that I would have allowed a missile like that to be in my publication. I would have prefaced that above my signature. This letter has arrived upon my desk. I believe it to have come from a cell where someone looking at soft walls was given a pencil and paper.
Well, and now a response from the Clavern.
No, I wouldn't have done that. I would have stuck with where I started. You know, read it at your own risk.
I mean, this thing's got a name on it. The guy's name's Brian W. Sourwine.
Get out the phone book. Find out if that's for real. That's from another century. What the heck is wrong with your newspaper running that crap? I mean, that gives such credence.
I mean the Nashville Tennessean or the Memphis Commercial Appeal would not run that letter.
No, I'm sorry. You know,
the Montgomery Advertiser would not run that letter.
This is 2006. In 1906, 100 years ago, they would have been hard pressed to accept that letter. What the heck's wrong with Charleston, West Virginia? I assume it was Charleston.
Charleston Gazette. I mean, the whole world can read this at wvgazette.com. Click on editorials and the reader voices or whatever the hell it is. Reader's Forum.
Well, the whole world may, but I shan't.
Yeah, well, you know, I had no choice. Like I said, silly me, it's like a train wreck. I always opened the letters to the editor first because... You know, there's always, once in a while you draw a gem out.
Well, I congratulate you on your perseverance and your incredible endurance, my man.
The Yankee North. This letter uses, I mean, we're Southerners, you know, we say Yankee in private.
Well, I say today, this very day, and this is for my brother, and I say that in the deepest, most sincere sense. My brother Wayne, please understand, yes, David is dangerous and has been for a week. I had occasion to call a benefit person at a company today, and they're centered in the north, and they figure in my financial future. And I laughingly called her a Yankee, and you know, there was no offense. You know, she understood, you know, we had...
Yeah, but this clown, you know... It was the Yankee North.
Well,
you know, it's moments like that that I read letters like that, David, and I think, got a long way to go. Yeah, I mean, it's one of those Jed Clampett moments. You know, one of these days, I got to have a long talk with that boy.
Well, never mind that. Let's go back to Sam Phillips.
Yeah, oh, yeah, let's do.
Let's go back to Sun Music. Let's go back to Steve Cropper, and let's go back to a wonderful keyboard player, and let's go back to Al Jackson, what was Jackson's first name? The greatest drummer in the world. Let's go back to Duck Dunn.
Oh, Donald Duck Dunn.
Let's go back to black and white men that went into a studio on Union Avenue in Memphis, Tennessee in the 50s, and they went in carefully because if the right white people had seen them going into that studio together, just the fact that a black man and a white man walked in the same door together, it would have been a problem. There could have been Memphis policemen show up there and cause them to have a problem. But they went in there because they loved music, they loved rhythm, they loved creativity, they loved each other, and some unknown blues player showed up there and cut some sides, and then with 15 minutes left on a book session, the part-time drummer, driver for that unknown blues man said, "I got a song my boss says we can cut if there's time. Is there time?" And Otis Redding cut, cut a song that became number one.
Yeah.
I Can't Stop Loving You. Oh, I've blown the title, but I can't remember what it is. Oh, anyway, Otis Redding's first song was cut that way. And that's when black and white didn't recognize, didn't acknowledge, didn't care, celebrated their differences and came together.
Well, and the same thing went on to happen in the Shoals where I grew up, David. Jerry Wexler.
Of course.
There's frankly, a lot of this has to do with the imagery that I use in my own head for where the Head On Radio Network is and will go. There's no historical marker there. There's no nothing. It's on Jackson Highway in Sheffield, Alabama, and it's a gray cinder block building, and it just says 3614 Jackson Highway. And the world changed there.
Of course it did.
And it changed there with Paul Anka and Sonny and Cher and the Rolling Stones and Bob Seger. But it started with what was called soul music. And it was done as a collaborative effort between really, really white people.
David Hood. A fellow named Johnson.
Yeah. And African American folk.
Better believe it.
And when the door shut on that soundproof room, and you look at the building and you're like, there's a soundproof room in there?
Yeah, almost.
I mean, the building's barely wide enough for a modern studio board.
And
the stuff that came out of there, I mean, anybody listening to this program who turns on their golden oldie station, I'd give you 3 hours before you hear a Muscle Shoals classic. And in that weird little area where I grew up, I mean, Sam Phillips picked up pop bottles in the Shoals before he ever went to Memphis, before he ever found Elvis. In that weird little area, amazing things happened. Because oddly enough, and there's a real point to this, David. Even to this day, the northwest corner of Alabama is the last bastion of hardcore Democrat voting in Alabama.
Well, I thank them for holding out. I thank them for holding out.
And you can go into Trowbridge's Ice Cream Parlor on the north end of Court Street, which has been open since God was a baby. And you can see a photograph of a smiling Woodrow Wilson waving from the back of a train at the train station down in East Florence because he had come to see the dam named in his honor. And that goes to the conversation I had with Andy about damming things and projects and, you know, doing it the right way. Wilson Dam was the first dam built on the Tennessee River. Because everybody downriver from the dam pretty much ate dirt, had no electricity, and lived in a malarial yellow fever jungle.
And if I may say, although not an Alabamian, but Tennesseans understand the process.
Yeah.
There's a phrase, come spring, you feared the flood.
Oh, yeah. And the thing is, you know, you can talk about living on floodplains, but the floodplain went wherever the rains happened to go. I mean, there's not a defined floodplain down there.
Bob, hold on. The floodplain ran from Clinton, Tennessee to Florence, Alabama on the river that's 180 miles. Nobody in that distance, in those valleys, was safe from March to June.
Yeah.
That's the way it had been prior to what the federal government chose to do to help some people along and create a benefit for all of the country.
So they hung that dam on the river. And it was one of those situations, I mean, my God, the labor involved. You know, people who haven't seen the Tennessee River, you've seen the Ohio, big river, bigger river, Tennessee River, different river. In the course of building that dam, the concrete had to be poured continuously. There was a camp of itinerant workers, migrant workers, if you will. People fell into the concrete, and the concrete had to keep pouring. There are human beings memorialized in that concrete.
That dam and virtually every one of the dams on the Tennessee...
From Nickajack?
Especially the TVA dams on the Clinch, the Holston, and French Broad, and whatever it may be. Somebody was lost in each one of those. And once you start a pour... And having worked construction to get myself through college, the phrase in the concrete trade is cold joint. If you stop pouring, you get to a certain magic, well, unmagic moment, where when you pour on top of it, it can't become a single thing. There is a seam between what you did 6, 5, 7, no matter what the number is, hours ago, and what you're doing now, if there's enough difference, the two things don't become one. They don't meld.
And it will not stay.
It will crack.
So, you know, working people were memorialized in that dam. And this thing, you know, this thing was built before the TVA came along. And people who have never seen the area, and I know you have seen the area, and... God knows if you have listened to a Drive-By Truckers album, you've become familiar with the area from that blood red carpet at the Salem Church of Christ.
Oh yeah.
To the references to the river.
Of course.
Henry Ford, long before there was a TVA, long before there was a Senator Norris from Nebraska. You know, this is, and he was one of those Republicans. It's the memory of people like Senator Norris that make me think that maybe there's a possibility somewhere along the way for an outreach, even in 21st century America. Senator Norris was a senator from Nebraska, and he was a maverick. And he looked down to the southeastern United States, and he said, these people got to have some help.
and the TVA was born out of his vision. His own party fought him. The Democrats fought him. Franklin Roosevelt didn't fight him. But before even Senator Norris came along, there was Henry Ford. And there's an area to this day that is generally referred to in that place as Ford City, Alabama. Henry Ford came down and laid out an entire city and started pouring concrete for sidewalks, built himself a little office building, because he hadn't committed to Detroit, Michigan at that time. He laid out Muscle Shoals, Alabama, and he put in a broad boulevard, and he called it, and anybody from Michigan will know, he called it Avalon Avenue. And he went to the federal government and he said, "I want your dam. I'll pay good money for it. I mean, you know, it's not like the taxpayers are going to get off. I mean, it's not like I'm going to rip off the taxpayer. I want your dam. I want your hydroelectric station. Because I am going to build my automotive empire in Northwest Alabama." And as the story goes, Woodrow Wilson said no. Because Henry Ford had it in his head that he was going to use the hydroelectric station at Wilson Dam to power his automotive industry and to power the workers' homes. As long as they weren't Jews, of course, because Henry Ford hated Jews.
Let's not go there.
But the federal government said no. No, this was done for the benefit of everybody who lives around here, not the next industrialist who wanders down the pike. Now, David, can you imagine George Bush having the guts to tell some industrialist, let's say Halliburton, that they couldn't have that dam?
Bob, George Bush would have pursued Halliburton finance it in the beginning. Not only would he have not resisted turning it over, he would have badgered them to take it on in the beginning, which would have trebled beyond their wildest expectations any profit expectation. Bush is in the bag of anybody with enough money to buy it. That's all they're about. Three generations ago, Bush's sold out America during the First World War. You can give chapter and verse on that.
Oh, yeah. And see, the thing is, and I realize maybe this is a tenuous stretch, but if that dam gets sold to Henry Ford, that has a ripple effect that reaches Tupelo, Mississippi.
Well, when the economic efficacy of it was over, and it would have been over 10 to 20 years ago, they would have walked away from it and said, "It isn't making us money now. Have a nice day."
Well, that kind of did happen because TVA screwed up. I mean,
look, we'll blow a horn when we think it's going to break. You know, you guys downstream, get out of the way. We'll be at the beach. See ya.
Yeah, but the thing is, it didn't happen, and you know, power went out, and the Rural Electrification Act went through. I mean, I happen to be the child of parents who remember the Rural Electrification Act, because that's when they stopped buying Delco batteries. I mean, I'm 43 years old, David, but, you know, I'm one generation away from Delco batteries powering your house.
Well, you had a grandmother that was speaking to you in great specificity. You had a grandmother, you had an uncle, you had somebody that was talking to you about what they had to live.
I had a mother and a father.
Okay, even better.
I mean, it's one of the weird, you know, my parents were so-called older parents.
So where most of my compadres' granddads fought in the Second World War, my dad did. But you know, we were talking about Sam Phillips and all of that stuff earlier.
Oh, and
the dam gets sold to Henry Ford. There's no Sam Phillips. And like I said, it ripples down to Tupelo, Mississippi, and Iuka, and Corinth. And there's no Elvis. And on the last day of June 2006, there's no Junichiro Koizumi singing Love Me Tender at Graceland.
Which is one of the freakiest things in the world. I'm really sorry.
Well, it's freaky. It's freaky on the one hand, but it's beautiful on the other, David.
Well, it's wonderful that something as dear and tender and creative and essentially human as Elvis is celebrated by that man, but it's also so intensely disturbing to me that on the day that an additional indictment regarding rape and murder and killing of innocents in a combat situation has come to light via the U.S. Army's indictment of some people, soldiers, George Bush is laughing, and rather than reading My Pet Goat, he's saying to Koizumi, hey, I thought she's going to sing Blue Suede Shoes.
You know, I've been avoiding that all night because I didn't have the outrage in me, David.
Sorry to bum.
No, you didn't bum me out, but that's what I keep trying to work around to. Elvis means something to Junichiro Koizumi that he doesn't mean to America. Elvis moves Junichiro Koizumi for reasons that he didn't ever move America.
Bob, I would disagree with you on that one.
Okay.
Having managed bands with men 25 years my junior that felt Elvis was the most important entertainer they were ever aware of, and these were punk rockers, and knowing people 15 years older than I am saying the only reason they understand music is Elvis. I firmly believe that Elvis is the most important artistic icon this country has produced in the last 50 years.
Now, of course, you're going to have to go toe-to-toe with the French over Jerry Lewis.
Just be quiet. I will accept and I will discuss until I fall over dead anything any person has to say to me regarding Miles Davis. But Jerry Lewis, he's a nice guy. He does great telethon. And I'm sorry. You know, anytime I can accurately imitate the most important thing the man ever said, Jerry Lewis does that. Oh, lady! Okay, I just took care of Jerry Lewis. You know, I'm sorry, Miles Davis had three different periods in which he rewrote the history of jazz music in North America, which means the world, and Elvis may be the most important interpreter of music as sung by the human voice ever to come out of North America. So let's get that straight. All right, let me say I throw that out there. And it's the bottom of the hour, and you need to wrap up. Oh, and it... Right.
Well, but see, I can't right now because I don't have a producer.
Oh, drat. Well, the Otis Redding song I couldn't remember correctly was These Arms of Mine with Steve Cropper playing, you know.
There's a little video going around. There's a little video going around somewhere that I saw while I was in Alabama about the Muscle Shoals music scene. I don't know if it's out on the net yet or not. I've got to look around and see if I can find it. But it would blow people away to realize that, you know, like I said, you tune into your golden oldie station, you hear Muscle Shoals.
Of course you do.
and most people don't even know it.
All right, now let's do a little bit of an insider question. Is it just me and you? You know, like, are you in a spot? Nobody's going to tell us to cut. Nobody's pointing at you and going, you know, it's the 30, get off.
Yeah.
Is that our situation?
Kind of.
Well, let's just keep talking until, are there calls? You know, callers, I should say?
Well, yeah, there's a caller online, but I can't, I got a break to run, and, you know, things are the way they are around here right now, crises being crises.
I'm not going to quit talking until you tell.
Well, okay, that's fine, but, it's not just for the hell of it, David. Okay, I tell you what, I got to take a break. We're going to have some dead air here. David, thank you very kindly. These things happen. These things happen as one invents a radio network.
You know what? I learned a long time ago. Well, long, not long for me, but long for others. 15, 18 years ago. I really came to grips with the DIY, the do-it-yourself aspect of any creative enterprise. And there's just things that are going to happen. And when they do, it's only, you know, it's like a pain of birth. It's like a contraction.
And we're having those right now. It's been kind of like that this week because there's been so much going on and so many,
you know, it's a little bit of a drive between this studio and where you need to be for several hours a day. That stuff happens. Well, anyway.
All right. David, thank you so much for your conversation. I appreciate it. So, you have yourself a wonderful weekend, and we'll talk soon.
Oh, we shall. Take care, Bob.
All right. Bye now. And we'll be back to more phone calls after this break. This is the Head On Radio Network.
When Bruce and I filled in for Bob Kincaid, we didn't know what to expect, but we sure didn't expect a call from the decider.
I told Walmart to sell the Easter egg dye kits, you know, the ones with the resurrection egg. We decided at Camp David that we were going to support Walmart and go with what the Lord told them and buy some of them resurrection egg kits. And, you know, I found the resurrection egg. God spoke to me through that egg. And God told me that I am the fourth member of the Holy Trinity. We're calling it the Holy Quadraphonic. And so now I'm the fourth voice of the Holy Trinity. So now I've got four voices in my head. I have the Father and the Son and the Holy Ghost and the Decider. I'm the Decider. I get to decide.
Don't miss Head On with Bob Kincaid weekdays 7 to 10 p.m. and Fourth Estate Radio with John Fox and Bruce Birch Saturdays 10 p.m. Eastern Time on the Head On Radio Network.
This is Bruce Birch, and I'd like to invite you to join me for a brand new show here on the Horn, the Bruce Birch Radio Program. Tune in Monday through Friday, 5 to 7 p.m. Eastern, right here on the Head On Radio Network.
the United Brotherhood of Carpenters and Millwrights, meet your most complex needs by providing productivity, competitiveness, reliability, accuracy, safety, leadership, and professionalism. Millwrights from the United Brotherhood of Carpenters are problem solvers. They accept any challenge and approach every project with the highest of competence and training. The UBC has thousands of professionals who can be at your service, giving you the best in business anytime and every time. The Head On Radio Network is proud to be sponsored by these wonderful men and women who are building the American dream every day. Thank you from the Head On Radio Network.
Minutes before the hour. I'm out from the bottom of the barrel now. You'd be amazed the number of switches and buttons and stuff that have to go on here to make a radio show. And, of course, given the family stuff that's going on here, people have to answer phone calls and... And I'm so grateful to David for sort of riding through a half hour with me. I hope you enjoyed the conversation as much as I did. At any rate, in the midst of all that, we have kept Luke from Knoxville, Tennessee, waiting till hell froze over. Icicles in Knoxville there, Luke?
Well, at least you hit the button and you didn't hear a snoring sound. No, like I said, I heard y'all talk about that, and it's sort of like, well, come on down, Bob. We'll take the trip, drive up from Alcoa to Fontana. You take your motion sickness pills, and I still to this day want to see how they took big trucks up and down that road.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
That's a road that's hairpin turn after hairpin turn, and I just would love to have seen them take 18-wheelers up that road.
But, you know, you're at the front end of everything David and I were talking about.
Oh, yeah. All of my mama's brothers, all four of them worked on Cherokee, helped build Cherokee.
Yeah.
So, you know what I mean? My grandparents' house is about 5 miles from Cherokee Dam.
And, there's some stuff that was covered up by all these dams that, you know, in retrospect would probably, we'd kind of like to have it back. The original Washington District... Before there was ever an independent United States, I mean, it's 4th of July, before there was ever an independent United States, there was the Washington District. Most of that's underwater now.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, there's just so many things that most people don't realize. They just recently had a month or so ago, there was a documentary that somebody just debuted about Oak Ridge. And most people don't realize when they built Oak Ridge, they destroyed three towns to build Oak Ridge.
Yeah.
You know, they just totally wiped out any trace of them because no one could know Oak Ridge existed. So where those towns were, they just kind of erased them.
And you know, that's kind of a national shame.
Yeah. But, you know, at the time, I'm sure they thought that was the best option they had. You know what I mean? But let me get on to what I want to talk to you about tonight. I'm sorry.
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. Did you get a chance to look at that link from PBS I sent you? The one about the banking thing when
I looked at it when we were talking.
December 2001, the Jim Blair show. They essentially told the whole story right then and there.
Like I said, I was down in Alabama for my 20th high school reunion, and I remember it being announced on public radio. That, you know, they had a brand new program to trace terrorist banking.
Yeah. You know, it just amazes me, all these news concerns. And it's like, you all don't have archives? You all didn't take a look? You know, see what all you all had done in 2000, you know, right after September 11th? because I remember they went after everybody. You know, anybody that had anything to do with Muslims in this country got looked up and down, one side and down the other.
Well, everybody except the people that needed a good looking at, because one of the things that Greg Palast did a wonderful job of is an investigation of an organization called WAMI, the World Association of Muslim Youth. And they were tied directly to the 9/11 hijackers, and the FBI completely left them alone.
Well, there was another one. I don't know if it's the same one. One that was involved with some fella named Grover Norquist, that he was a big contributor to. That amazingly enough, they didn't get examined either. You know, so you know, it's like I say, they were real thorough, except that little selective part they don't want to tell you about.
Well, and that's the thing that really gets under my fingernails is. An objection to what passes for modern journalism, because we know now, because of the case that was ruled on a couple of weeks ago where the federal district judge in Brooklyn said, well, you know, the president can detain anybody he wants to anytime he wants to. That's from the general roundup of 2001, where people who happened to be dark-skinned or wearing something funny on their head got hauled into prison and haven't been let out since. And, you know, we just sort of don't know about them.
Yeah, sort of like, no, there is no proof of guilt. You just have to prove you're innocent.
Yeah, but you've got to sort of juxtapose that against the royal family of Saudi Arabia and Michael Moore. You know, all the right wingers said, well, that's just a bunch of lies what Michael Moore's saying about the royal family being flown out of this country before they could be questioned. That ain't true. That's a bunch of lies. Yeah, it turns out it was true.
Mm-hmm. One inch to the other. Did you get the one I sent you today about somebody who we found is even bug spray crazier than Rick Santorum? Representative Kurt Weldon.
Oh, Kurt, well, we've known Kurt Weldon was crazier than a sprayed roach for a long time. Long time.
But you see this one now about he was wanting to go to Iraq himself to dig up the WMDs.
Yeah, I saw that. Give him a shovel and let him go.
Let him go. Give him a camel, a map, and a compass and say, get to it, son.
Yeah, you get, you know, stand not upon the order of your going, my lad, but go at once.
You know, we'll give you the white flowing robes, and when you find him, you call. We'll come a running.
But you know that it's interesting. I did see where you sent that along. I find it interesting that on the same day that we have that story, we have the story about how the family of Abu Musab al-Zarqawi is saying, "Can we please have the body?"
Yeah.
And the United States has said, you know, we'd love to give you the body, but yeah, we don't know where it is. Because we turned it over to the legitimate Iraqi government, and they buried it somewhere in the desert in an unmarked grave with all the proper Muslim obsequies, and we don't know where it is.
Oh, yeah, we didn't want to know where we put it. We just, you know, drove by and kicked it out of the truck as we drove, you know. It's like, God, you know what I mean? It's one of those things. It's like, guys, you don't keep track of something like this? You know?
I know. It's just disgusting.
It's one of those things. I was sitting there tonight, earlier tonight, and I was just flipping around channels, and I hit across up close on C-SPAN, where they were doing one of their things from the museum, you know, where they were talking to some reporters. And I still, every time, you know, in 2006, and I want to do it in 2008, every time some of these reporters start talking about the presidential election, I go, yeah, are y'all going to tell us how this next Republican's just a good old boy? We don't need to worry about him being competent. You know, it's like, boy, you all really did well that last one. Are you real still, like you said before, how's that vote working out? You know, how are those stories working out telling us that we don't need somebody that's competent?
No. Luke, I remember when they said the grown-ups are going to be in charge now. As if, you know, as if the Clinton administration, you know, headed by, a president who was a freaking Rhodes Scholar.
Well, and the guy who is running, who is the vice president, is essentially the man who wrote the SALT treaties. You know, if you look into some of the stuff Al Gore did, he essentially was the main architect of the SALT treaties. You know, and I mean, it's like,
Well, you know, maybe their definition of grown-ups is different than ours.
Well, it's like
maybe their definition of grown-ups is mean.
Well, their idea of grown-up to me seems to be the word con man, because I still to this day still want to go, yeah, why don't y'all tell us about that No Child Left Behind thing and how well that works? It's like, of course, this time, can you tell us about the 40% of kids they kicked out of school before they took the test?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. My sister-in-law, my brother and my sister-in-law lived down in San Antonio about 10 years ago, or people a little bit further back than that. They told me how that worked. It's sort of like, gee, you know, it's time for the test. Well, let's take the DNS students, and we'll either expel them or transfer them. So the only people taking the test are the A, B, and C students. Lo and behold, the test looked wonderful.
Oh, yeah.
It's like, God. It's like, yeah, sure it does.
Well, you know, and that's been repeated 1,000 times across the United States, Luke.
I know. It's one of those things. It's sort of like, you know, these numbers look real good. Yeah, but you have to understand all the teachers have been told, teach the test. Don't teach the subject. Teach the test.
I've seen the test notebook.
Oh.
You know, it's like a 3-ring binder that's 3 inches thick.
Oh.
And that's the test they have to teach.
Yeah.
And everything else goes out the window.
Oh.
I remember, you know, our eldest who, you know, mercifully graduated high school. I remember talking to her English teacher, and she said, I have to give my spelling tests in multiple choice now.
Well, you know, it's one of those things. My sister-in-law said, they essentially came down and told them, said, you cannot take time to teach them other things. You have to teach the test, because if the test scores go down, our money goes away. That's the whole thing. You lose your job. Yeah. It's like, if they do not pass this test, you do not pass this test, essentially.
Precisely.
So, it's just amazing. It's like, say, we're in 2 more years, hopefully we have a Democrat come in, we're going to get to look at the books. And we think things are bad now. I hate to imagine what all they're still covering up that we ain't caught yet.
And see, the thing is, there are good people out there who have the right idea about the war and have the right idea about government. And yet they're still hanging on to some of this libertarian garbage about how the public school system is government schools. You know, as if this was the Soviet Union.
Well, you know, I remember when the big thing was a few years ago when it was homeschooling. And you know how good and well the right side of the world is here in East Tennessee.
Oh, yeah.
And it's sort of like, yeah, you get looking at it and you read some of their literature, and it's like, yeah, and you do know that the sun rises and sets on Ronald Reagan. Nothing happened before
him. Well, yeah, but see, even in the Bush era, I forget the name of his first education secretary, Rod Page.
That's him. It turns out
he fudged up, dummied up, ginned up the entire Texas test scores.
He kicked out 40% of the kids before he gave them the test.
Right, and then there's the charter schools.
Oh gosh, oh please, we had. Now I think he honestly was a pretty good fella, but I think he got a little too far ahead of himself. Remember, we had Chris Whittle here, and the whole Whittlesburg and all that.
Yeah,
you know, with the Channel One and that whole thing.
No, the whole thing's a fraud, Luke. It's all a big ripoff.
But, I mean, I think there are some people on the edges who want to do good, but you know what I mean? There are so many people running it who don't care.
Well, we're gonna have the president of the West Virginia Education Association on this program Wednesday night next.
Okay.
And we're going to talk about a bunch of this stuff.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of cute. Greg Palast's new book has reference to No Child's Behind Left.
I've got it sitting right in front of me.
You know where the first place he ever heard that phrase?
Mm-hmm.
An interview with me in Beckley in 2004.
Oh, Lord. No, it's one of those things. It's like, say, some of the things that have been done. And like I say, a lot of them have fallen between the cracks that the people were watching, you know, watching the left hand and weren't watching the right hand.
Cracks will kill you.
Oh, But you know what I mean? It's going to be interesting when the reckoning comes and they start seeing, oh, this is what was done while you all were asleep at the switch.
Yeah, yeah.
So.
I mean, I feel so bad for the public school system because my grandmother, her sister, her other sister, her other sister, her daughter, my sister, most of the females in my family have dedicated themselves to education. And every time I hear some damned Republican say, oh, you know, education is a failure because they're not teaching people that Jesus rode dinosaurs, it just makes me so mad because that's such a, it's not a slap, it's a spit in the face of the dedication of my family,
I mean,
you know?
Well, I'll be honest, the way the right-wingers want to redo the history books, I'd sooner read a Stephen King novel. And swear that's the truth. You know what I mean?
Sooner, it's the same thing. Hey, Luke, we're out of time, brother.
All right, you have a good week.
All right, you take care.
Alrighty.
Look forward to hearing from you maybe this week on the Fourth Estate.
All righty.
Later.
Bye.
That's it. The end of a very, very, very busy week.
Not yet.
And I didn't. John. Yeah, we've still got John coming up this evening, all foxed up. I meant the end of a busy week for me, dear. Us. It's the beginning.
That's right.
All Foxed Up is next. Now, tonight, of course, the program was produced under difficult circumstances by my lovely, darling wife, Agnes. It was announced by Brian Reznor, Ben Birch at WhiteRoseSociety.org. Maintains the stream and all the archives and the podcasting of the Head On Radio Network and many other fine liberal programs as well. He has a fundraiser going on. Do the right thing, please. Peter Godbold of Godbold Computers of Tallahassee, Florida. Is our IT professional. The show is sponsored, and the entire network is sponsored, by the West Virginia District Council of Carpenters and Millwrights. They are building the American dream, and by supporting this network, they're saving the American dream. And always, 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 RMR, it's all for you.